Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
A $28 million emergency spending bill to help address Flint's water crisis is now headed to Governor Rick Snyder's desk for his signature. $3 million of that has been set aside to, quote, aid with utility and unpaid bills. Whether or not to pay for water they're unable to use has been such a big question for Flint residents. Their water rates are already among the highest in Michigan. Just today, residents and activists were protesting at Flint City Hall, calling for a moratorium on water bills. With us now are two women wrestling with that very dilemma, and they've each come up with a different answer. Amber Hassan has not paid her water bill since last fall. Welcome, Amber.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good to have you with us. And we have Laura McIntyre with us. Laura continues to pay. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Amber, let's start with asking, how much do you currently owe?
I currently owe $694.
And why did you make that decision to stop paying?
I spend more each month on bottled water and jugs of water than I need to pay for a water bill. I spend about $300 a month, bare minimum, for bottled water and jugs of water. My water bill is $214 a month, and that's just for us using showers and using the water to wash clothes with.
Was it a tough decision to say, I am consciously not going to pay my bill?
Oh, yes, especially being a homeowner, because if you don't pay your water bill, they can condemn your property and they can seize your property.
Now, you haven't had anything reached out to you yet about that, right?
No, and I don't currently have a shut-off notice.
Okay.
Before I did stop paying, I was up to date. I was paying my water bill. But that's one of the things, you don't want your water shut off.
Sure.
You know, consumers, you may be able to get by for a week without, you know, if it's not cold out, without consumers. You can't get by without water.
But you felt it's important to make this statement.
Definitely. It's kind of like, well, we poisoned you, but you paid for it. And even after you knew it was poison, you continued to pay for it.
All right, Laura, let me take the flip side of that coin. Why have you chosen to continue paying?
Well, I have to start off saying that I think Amber is wonderful, and I so admire your decision. I think you're so brave, and I don't want to be paying my water bill, not because it's of the financial costs that are incurred, but because as a political statement, I don't think that we should be paying for something that we shouldn't use and that we're being overcharged for. But that being said, my family is paying the water bill because out of all things considered in this water fight and with the fight against the financial emergency manager and other things that are happening in the city, there's, you know, we feel like there's only so many things that we can, you know, butt our heads up against. So in consultation with the Democracy Defense League and What Are You Fighting For?, we've consulted with people. Nayira Sharif with Democracy Defense League, I've had several conversations with her about, you know, what needs to be done in order to make that protest and not pay your water bill. And if we were to do it, we would, you know, try to set up an escrow account so that there wouldn't be any legal repercussions. We do own our home as well, and we don't want, anything to happen with that. And also, it's just really difficult when your water is shut off. It's very difficult to get it turned back on. It's, $150 reconnect fee just to get it turned back on. So it's, out of all things that we're battling with, it's just something we decided not to deal with at this particular time. And I do also have to say that in terms of establishing an escrow account so that you can do it legally, I mean, not pay your bill legally, there was no judge that would accept that. We could not find a judge to establish escrow accounts to make that, kind of political statement. Nobody would agree to do that.
So, no, they won't. It's much different than if you are going against a landlord and you're saying, well, they're not meeting my needs, I'm going to put this money in this account. You right. basically have to just put the money up yourself. And if it comes down to them, if they're going to come cut you off, then you have to make that choice.
Right. But I mean, Melissa Mays and What Are You Fighting For? was trying to find a judge who would be willing to work with folks to set up an escrow account, and they all refused.
I wonder if that might be changing as more and more attention is focused on the situation. But Amber, are you setting money aside in case they do come banging
Definitely.
At your door?
Definitely. It wouldn't be smart for me not to. Because at the end of the day, I do have children, and I'm going to have to make that decision. There's going to come a point where I have to make that decision, where I have to make that choice of whether I'm going to say, no, I'm not paying it, or, whether I'm going to break down and pay it. That's going to come into the balance eventually. Me and my kids talk about it all the time. We talk about what's important, what do you value. And at the end of the day, my kids are kind of like, well, we don't use it anyway. And they, I had to explain to them that if they cut it off, they can seize our property and things of that nature. My kids don't want to be here anymore anyway.
I remember talking on this program about the issue before Dr. Mark Edwards and before Dr. Mona's reports really blew this open about the lead. That last summer, even a Genesee County judge ordered the city of Flint to remove what were seen as unlawful charges, the high, high rates you were paying in Flint. That didn't happen. The city's been found in contempt. And I have to wonder, does it feel also like your own city is against you at times? Your laughter. Who wants that one first, Amber?
It definitely feels like they're against us. It feels like we don't, our rights are just simply being ignored. We voted against the emergency manager. We got the emergency manager. The city of Flint, we voted against the switchover. We got the switchover anyways because the emergency manager decided we were going to get the switchover. I mean, it feels like we have no say-so. At this point, it's like we have a voice, but when we shout it out, it just gets lost somewhere out there. Like, who's listening? And I'm glad that we get this attention right now, but I don't want it to be a 15 minutes of attention. And then in 2 months, these same people who are going to get water bottles from the fire station have nowhere to get water bottles from.
And I have to say that I don't feel like the city is against me. I feel like the city administrator, the governor of Michigan, is against the people in Flint. This is our city. We're not against, and I know Amber feels
the
same way.
Yeah, that's what I mean when I say the city. Yeah. I mean, the powers that be. It's not...
The state-appointed emergency manager. The state-appointed.
Yes. The state itself, MEDEC, the Environmental Protection Agency. I feel those things that are against us and that we are the city. And we keep saying no, and it keeps getting ignored. We demand FOIA requests, and they just get ignored or even laughed at. I mean, that's part of the real problem, is that we're not just being ignored. We're being mocked and laughed at for having this problem.
And we have people who have the nerve to say that, oh, it's not as bad as they're saying. When we had the first boil water advisories because it was E. coli in the water, oh, it's not that bad. When we had the TTHC in the water, oh, it's not that bad. Now we have lead in the water. We have kids who have been lead poisoned. And
Legionnaire's disease.
Legionnaire's disease. And now, people dying. And people are saying, oh, well, it's really not that bad. Like, we're making it bigger than what it seems. Nobody wants to be known for being the city that that kids get lead poisoning in. Nobody wants to be known for that.
Let me ask you something back to this issue of paying or not paying a water bill, that the city has made the point, hey, we still have to pay for sewer operations, we have to pay for the water operations, and that's what, you know, that money is needed for. Where do you think the money for that should come?
Since they haven't paid back the 30% that they overcharged us, maybe it could come from there. That's just, you know, I'm no financial analyst or economist or any, you know, I don't pretend to be, but I would just think that, you know, since we were overcharged 30% for a few years, how about wherever they put that money, they take it from there.
We also have a budget surplus, and I also think turning that question around and asking, well, where is this money going to come from, is part of the problem that got us into this situation in the first place. This whole focus on austerity and tightening belts and budgets mm-hmm. and making people pay for things, this is a public health issue. When you have people with Legionnaire's disease, it's not like it's going to stay within the boundary of Flint, too. I mean, it's like getting typhoid or the plague. You know, yep. You can't have your infrastructure deteriorate to the point where it, you know, becomes a life or death matter. So this is something, this is, we're actually talking about the commons. We're talking about what everybody needs to contribute to and not, you know, on a state level, a neighborhood level, a city level, a state level, a country level. This is just something that needs to be taken care of. So the issue of where the money is going to come from, I think, is like a diversionary tactic. I mean, it definitely has to come from somewhere, but we also need to look at, you know, the tax structure and how the state budget is financed. And, you know, like Amber, I'm not an expert in those areas, but I do know that with Governor Snyder's, you know, financial management of the city, all of our public services have deteriorated to the point where they're no longer functioning. The Detroit Public Schools are an example of this. Flint isn't the only one with the water infrastructure in this condition. And this is just tip of the iceberg. This is just the
Buena
tip of the
Vista
iceberg.
As well. I know for sure Buena Vista, they found the TPHC in their water. And also going along with that, I don't think you asked the victim, how are we going to pay for this? I don't think somebody, you know, steals your car and then asks you, well, how are you going to replace your car? You know, right. I don't think that you look towards the victims like, well, we still got to pay for this stuff, so you guys got to pay for it. And it's like we've been overpaying for stuff we can't use.
That's great. Illegally charged overpayment for things that we,
yeah.
And the money was supposed to have gone partially into part of the infrastructure instead of paying off the debt for the city. So there's been mismanagement all around. It's not up to, you know, us necessarily to fix it, and it does have to come up from a, you know, from a higher level.
Laura McIntyre and Amber Hassan of Flint, it was great to meet you, and we want to thank you so much for being very frank and sharing your stories with us. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I came as Harriet Tubman up with the truth to sojourner. Other times I had to come as Nat Turner.
The Sundance Film Festival in Utah started out as a venue for low-budget works by independent filmmakers looking for distribution. When major studios bought those films, the purchase price was usually modest. That's still true, but it is changing, and this week the model was broken. Fox Searchlight paid an astounding $17.5 million for a biopic about Nat Turner, who led a legendary slave rebellion in the early 1800s in Virginia. The film is called The Birth of a Nation, directed, written, produced, and starring Nate Parker. Justin Chang is the chief film critic for Variety, and he was at that premiere at Sundance. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, okay, this film comes at a time when controversy over a lack of diversity in the film industry is swirling through Hollywood. It sounds like this has become the most talked about film at the festival this year.
It certainly has. I think it is very much a movie of the moment. It sort of crystallizes a lot of things. The lack of diversity in the ranks of the industry, which, you know, as we've seen with the Oscars so white controversy. And it's also, I think, you know, the title of the film is The Birth of a Nation, which is very consciously a reference and sort of a rebuke to D.W. Griffith's 1915 epic of the same title, which is, of course, still notorious for its racist imagery, its heroic portrayal of the Ku Klux Klan. The Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker's film, is intended as a corrective to that. It is a story of American slavery told from the perspective of the African American slaves who endured it.
Well, you know, talking about back to the money here in the 21st century, put that $17.5 million in perspective for us. How does it stack up against other films at the Sundance?
So $17.5 million for The Birth of a Nation is pretty huge. And I think it is a response and a reflection of the tremendous reception that the film received. People were on their feet. People don't always give the director and the cast and crew a standing ovation, but the response to this film was thunderous.
Well, you know, just from the perspective of a film critic, which you are, how good is this film? How would you rate it?
I think it's very good indeed. I mean it as no condescension at all to say that you wouldn't know that this was the work of a first-time filmmaker, Nate Parker, who's an actor who has incredible charisma and presence in films like Beyond the Lights and Arbitrage. This is a passion project that he pursued for 7 years. A lot of people are going to be really shaken and moved, as they should be, by the end of the film, which recreates the uprising and the retaliation against 200 African Americans were killed, even people who did not participate in the uprising. Just that part of the movie, it almost becomes like a slavery-era version of Braveheart. But I think what's more impressive about the movie even is just how thoughtful it is. Nat Turner was a preacher. He was a man of God. And the movie is kind of tracing the slow and steady process of wrestling with his beliefs and his convictions and coming to the conclusion that they had to commit murder in order to do this. And it's a really compelling arc that he undergoes in the film. It's not as great a film as 12 Years a Slave, but very few films are. But I think it's a pretty remarkable piece of work all the same.
Justin Chang is the chief film critic for Variety. He talked to us from Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure.
Every school kid in America hears about Martin Luther King's dream, little white and black children joining hands. That was not King in Chicago.
If there is to be genuine equality, there must be a radical redistribution of economic and political power.
This is not your school mural version of King. In Chicago, he announced a full-scale assault on slum conditions, and he didn't just mean housing. He talked about a slum economy, slum jobs, slum schools. The whole agenda was dubbed a campaign to end slums, but I think that needs a modern-day translation.
A campaign to end poverty.
That's Claiborne Carson, a premier King historian. Ending poverty was King's true life commitment, Carson says. It came from his Christianity.
As far back as 1948, he's writing about unemployment, slums, economic insecurity. That was his identity as a social gospel minister, dealing with those issues.
The dream King talked about in Chicago was a 60% increase to the minimum wage. He called for a guaranteed minimum income, the idea that no family should live below a certain threshold. He wanted tenant unions, a union for the unemployed, even a union for welfare recipients. He called for jobs and massive investment in the ghettos.
We are dealing with hard economic and social issues. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to get a program that will force the government to put billions of dollars into ending slums.
In the South, there were lunch counters. In Chicago, there were ghettos. King moved into a third-floor slum apartment in North Lawndale, 1550 South Hamlin Avenue. The day he arrived, Lawndale residents filled the street to watch. Little kids went upstairs to see if it was really true that the Reverend Martin Luther King had moved in. Members of the Vice Lord's street gang came by.
He wanted to live with the people that he cared most about. And it was the poor people that he was most concerned about.
He just became part of the community.
Mary Lou Finley and Bernard Lafayette were both staffers on the Chicago campaign back then. By this time, King had won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was speaking all over the country. Now, in North Lawndale, the stairwell of his building smelled like urine. The door to the street wouldn't lock. North Lawndale had too many people crammed into too little space, since city leaders and the real estate industry kept blacks restricted to certain areas. There were rodents and roaches, apartments without heat. Lafayette says King was in Lawndale to listen.
That was probably the most astute part of his approach to solving problems, to listen to the people and not make assumptions about the problem, but to see if he could understand their lives from their perspective.
King held mass meetings in little neighborhood churches. He bought the newspaper at 16th and Ridgeway. He talked to regular Chicagoans on the airwaves. Here's a call-in show from WVON.
Yes, Dr. King, would you object to answering a question if it were not in the same viewpoint that you have?
Of course not. I'd be willing to try to answer any question. There's
Thank
always
you very
room
much.
For dissent.
I would like to ask you if you think Chicago is the worst city that you've been in.
That's a difficult question to answer because we have a lot of problems in all of our cities.
When King's stay in Chicago is remembered, it's usually for the open housing marches that sought to knock down the walls of the ghetto and the incredible violence King encountered as white residents attacked him and others protesting segregation and housing discrimination. While King had vowed to unleash a nonviolent army on each and every issue in the slums, it proved impossible to fight a battle with so many fronts. Open housing eventually became the movement's focus.
My place is in Gage Park. My place is in Belmont Craig. And my place is in Cicero.
Today, we associate King more with the all-white neighborhoods he marched through, like Marquette Park. And we sometimes forget the fight for open housing in Chicago was not only a protest against racial discrimination, it was also part of the much broader effort to cure slum conditions in places like North Lawndale. Back on Hamlin, Irene Powell lives across the street from where King lived.
All right, yeah. Peeking out the window.
Powell is 87. She's sitting in the same window she watched King through all those years ago.
It was just a good thing to, you know, to be able to look up on him, you know. But I also heard him say that Chicago was by one of the prettiest places that he ever been, even though they kind of sneaky with it.
Mrs. Powell is talking to me with no teeth. Her life is a metaphor for everything achieved and not achieved these last 50 years. When King lived here, the Powells rented this apartment. Her husband worked in a meatpacking house. She took night jobs. They managed to raise 16 kids and buy the building. But it's been tough holding on to it between mortgage scams and city inspectors. She says one of her sons was killed by police. Four generations of her children have attended the segregated school down the street. King was here to end the slums, but to Mrs. Powell, those now look like the neighborhood's good years. After King was assassinated, rioters burned 16th Street, and 48 years later, the scars are still here. Whole blocks sit vacant. 1550 South Hamlin was torn down. A greater percentage of North Lawndale families live in poverty today than when King was here.
I just want to see more good things. I want to see some blooming up, some coming up.
There's a little bit of blooming up. For past anniversaries of King's arrival, 1550 South Hamlin was a vacant lot. No sign King had ever lived here. Today, for the 50th anniversary, Mrs. Powell looks out on the Martin Luther King Legacy Apartments, 45 units, affordable housing, built 5 years ago by the Lawndale Christian Development Corporation. I met the family who lives at 1550 South Hamlin, number 3. A beautiful family, 5 kids, deeply religious. I think it's safe to say that King would love their building, but he'd be troubled by neighborhood violence so bad their kids can't play outside. Troubled the father spent 3 years unemployed. Troubled by the $8 an hour job he finally landed. When you convert that, it's less than what minimum wage was back in 1966. Historians say that it was in Chicago that King sowed the seeds of the Poor People's Campaign he was working on when he was assassinated.
It is a Poor People's Campaign. That's what we are, Poor People's. Yeah, we just ain't campaigning, but...
From her window, Mrs. Powell is still looking out at many of the same problems King came to Chicago 50 years ago to fix. Linda Lutton, WBEZ.
You have any idea what a burden you people are on the taxpayer?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because of his excellent academic record, I'm going to give him a life sentence this time. But if I ever see your son in the courtroom again, I'm going to lock him up and throw away the key. I'm going to lock you up with him.
What they give you, blood? 3 months, man. What you doing in here anyway? You ought to be home with your mama. How old are you, boy?
13.
Damn. Bastards must be running out of niggas to arrest.
Well, as you've been hearing, President Obama is banning the use of solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons. In an op-ed in the Washington Post, the president cited Khalif Browder, a young Bronx man who spent years in solitary as a teenager despite never being convicted of a crime. He later committed suicide. The president also outlined other executive actions, including reforms to the way adults are held in solitary and the expansion of mental health treatment. To get some perspective on this issue, we're joined now by Johnny Perez, an advocate with the New York City-based Mental Health Project of the Urban Justice Center. He spent 3 years in solitary while incarcerated in New York. Johnny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Richard. Really appreciate it.
So what's your reaction to all of this? I mean, how significant are these changes that the president's suggesting for the federal prisons?
I definitely welcome, you know, the president's announcement is welcome news. I think that is definitely going to make an impact on a number of young people, you know, that are currently being held, you know, in solitary. However, I do want to say that, you know, it's a step in the right direction, although, but we need more. I think that the number of people that are affects roughly about 10,000 teenagers of about 100,000 people that are currently incarcerated in solitary across the nation. So although I think it's a step in the right direction, I think that the president can do more and expand the same relief to adults.
So, as we mentioned, you spent some time in solitary. Can you talk about that experience and why you say that that practice should be banned? Because people on the other side of the argument say that solitary is a tool to keep order in a prison.
Absolutely. I think that, yes, definitely prisons should have tools in order to keep, you know, control inside the prison. But I also feel that there is no situation in which a person needs to be treated inhumanely in order to hold them accountable. For myself, I spent 3 years in solitary, and I can tell you, you know, from direct experience that, you know, you have little to no human contact. You have, you know, no educational programs, no drug treatment programs. I was placed in solitary for over a year for testing positive for marijuana. So you have large, huge number of folks who are in there for minor offenses, and you know they're, you know, going over 12 hours without receiving any kind of food. You know, I lost about 30 pounds while I was in there. You know, the light stays on all day. You know, the officers dehumanize you, no eye contact, don't even want to talk to you. The food is often cold. My toilet was stuck for about 3 days. I didn't get it fixed for like 3 days later. So when we're talking about these conditions, not only of course juveniles do not absolutely deserve to be in there, but we also need to keep in mind that it's inhumane for all people, not just juveniles.
Now we're talking at the federal level, but what's happening at the state level regarding the use of solitary? I know it's trying to be limited perhaps at the local level here in New York City at Rikers Island.
Yeah, absolutely. They have limited it in some instances. Right now, what we're trying to do is we're trying to, you know, actually the HALT Act, which stands for the Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Isolated Confinement. And right now, we do have some mobility. We have 13 state senators, and we have 44 assembly members who have co-signed onto the bill. And the bill is one of the most progressive pieces of legislation being looked at right now, which will drastically, reduce not only the amount of solitary, but the way in which it's used and provide humane alternatives in order to treat those who are in that condition, in the custody.
So would you say that's the next step? Is that the most important in the next steps in reform here?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I think that we need to bring it in line with the UN repertoire on torture that deemed anything over 15 days to be considered torture. Right now, as we speak, you know, New York State does have people who are incarcerated in those human cages, living in captivity for over, years at a time. So I definitely think that the HALT Act is definitely the next most progressive sweeping reform that the president needs to take a look at as a model when he's taking a look at positive future legislation on this subject.
Okay, Johnny Perez works with the Mental Health Project of the Urban Justice Center. Johnny, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
It is rare for a publisher to halt distribution of a book. But last week, Scholastic Publishing announced it would pull a children's book called A Birthday Cake for George Washington. The book caused an outcry because of how it portrayed Washington's enslaved household cook and his daughter, showing them as happy, smiling workers. The controversy continues. This past Friday, the National Coalition Against Censorship released an objection to Scholastic's decision, saying the book can be used as a teaching tool to discuss a tragic chapter in our country's history. So we wondered what the answer is. Put simply, how do you read a book to your kid that has problematic, maybe even racist material in it? Should you just skip it altogether? Jeremy Adam Smith says no. He spoke with me from Berkeley, California, where he edits Greater Good Science magazine for the university there. And I asked him why he thinks we should tackle these books with our children head on.
Mainly because a history of slavery and racial inequality in this country exists. But more than that, I think encountering this kind of imagery in children's books is an opportunity for parents to talk specifically about how, if we're not aware of secret messages in books that they're reading or aware of our unconscious impulses, then we become slaves to those messages and those impulses. Mm-hmm. And that's fundamental to parenting. You know, it's a form of teaching impulse control.
So let's walk through a couple of different examples or situations, rather. There is a kind of book that a parent might, you know, want to pick up because they want to share it with their child.
Yeah.
One of our editors here had this happen with a book that she was reading to her child, the Little House series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is something she has, you know, a strong emotional attachment to. She wanted to share it with her kids. And, you know, you start reading those pages and all of a sudden Pa Ingalls is going to a minstrel show.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I read those books aloud to my son, and I also felt ambushed by some of the racist imagery in the books, which nobody had done anything to prepare me for. You know, what I did was I closed the book and I said, how do you think it would make you feel if you were black and you were reading this? And we talked about that. And this was a lesson. I think we had this conversation when my son was about 7 years old. Mm. A lot of it went over his head. However, it was the beginning of a discussion that continues to this day as he approaches 12 years old.
So we've been talking about race and how it can be embedded in children's literature. But gender issues, gender discrimination is also something that can pop up when you pluck a children's book from a shelf.
Right.
Is this something you've noticed?
The short answer is yes, I have noticed. You know, I think in some ways gender is even more complicated because people don't agree about what constitutes discrimination. Many people are very wedded to the idea that there are just fundamental differences between boys and girls, men and women. You know, and that can be actually really hard to talk about because girls who depart from that script about what a girl should be or boys who depart from that script about what a boy should be are often teased mercilessly in school. I think for us as parents, that causes a lot of anxiety. You know, I think that the key is to be brave about it. I think that if you believe that gender equality is something worth pursuing, then it's very well worth it to take a moment and to talk about these things and to talk in a conscious way about what happens to boys who don't act like quote-unquote boys or girls who don't act like quote-unquote girls. This is an opportunity to talk about being brave in that context and standing up to bullies who tease people for things that are just inherent in their identity.
What about books that try to use it as a teachable kind of experience like you're talking about? I mean, for example, I sat down with my 3-year-old with a book that is part of this series. They're called Value Books that I grew up with, and I love these books. And he picked out a story about Ralph Bunche. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we're reading about how this young kid had to face segregation and all kinds of racial discrimination. And I found myself skimming through these pages really quickly and, like, summarizing the story and feeling like, oh, man, you're three, and I don't think we should be talking about this stuff, but maybe we should.
Well, you know, I think one of the terrible secrets of adulthood is that we often just forget to be brave. A moment comes, and it's a moment when we're called upon to be brave, and sometimes we're just not paying attention, or that impulse to protect our children. I mean, I would argue that what you were experiencing springs from something that's just fundamental to human psychology, which is to protect your child from the harshest things in life. So think about this as a parenting issue, the same way you think about potty training or sleep training. This is part of life. It's part of American life. And I think that it's incumbent upon parents to think beforehand how they're going to deal with these issues when they come up, because they will come up.
Jeremy Adam Smith is an editor at Greater Good Magazine. He's also the author and editor of the anthology, Are We Born Racist? Jeremy, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Damn you, Obama.
Several students at a Howard County high school tonight are facing possible discipline after a disturbing and racist rant. This video has been shared hundreds of times out there on social media.
So one student is rolling, another is calling blacks, quote, an inferior race, and says, who cares when some black man dies? Bruce LeShan is live in Ellicott City, where the school superintendent is hoping that this can be a teachable moment. Bruce, this was pretty shocking for a lot of people.
Pretty shocking, Leslie, and they're hoping here that this is a teachable moment, not just on tolerance in this diverse community, but also on the potential consequences of spreading this kind of racial hatred.
Okay. Seriously, okay? Who the cares when some black man dies?
The video shot at a student's home is a 30-second rant about the Black Lives Matter movement.
They're an inferior race.
The high school student rails about African Americans while others in the crowd egg him on. Eventually, he waves a $5 bill up to the camera to show President Lincoln's face.
All right, this guy is a traitor to the white race.
The video went viral, shared widely among students from Mount Hebron High School in Ellicott City. School leaders are urging students to stop sharing it and to delete their posts about it.
When you see the video, you should report it or delete the tweets or Facebook comments or messages.
The superintendent sent a message to all parents in the county saying the behavior will not be tolerated. Mount Hebron's principal has already scheduled meetings with the students and their parents.
Student code of conduct actually does address outside of school, behavior that's outside of school.
Kids in my physics class, but, you know, normal there, but...
David Allen is a junior at Mount Hebron.
Do you feel like there's discrimination against African Americans at the school?
No, at least not from the teachers.
Not from the teachers?
Not from the teachers.
And what about from the students?
A little bit here and there.
My personal opinion is that black lives do matter. I believe every life matters.
I don't know if they're completely serious, but I don't think it's a very good joke if they weren't serious.
Now, the students that we talked to today at Mount Hebron said that the student should be forgiven. He has since apologized on Facebook for his comments. They said, the students, that we should all just move on. But it is not clear that school leaders feel the same way. Live in Ellicott City, Bruce LeShan, WUSA 9.
There's a lot of conversation that will come from this, Bruce. Thank you. Students say this is not the first case of racism at Mount Hebron. They say many African American students spend time between classes at an intersection of hallways, and some students have taken to referring to that spot as, quote, the jungle. But a school spokesman says there is a new principal at the school and the superintendent is expecting changes. New at 5, a bad hangover for some high school students after a weekend party in San Francisco. There was drinking, but the theme of the party is what got the teenagers suspended. Our Mike on the beer bash that may have crossed the line when it comes to race and culture. Mike?
Well, St. Ignatius is one of the city's top prestigious private prep schools, Catholic schools. In San Francisco, it educates some of the elite's sons and daughters, but they weren't acting like it this weekend. While most of St. Ignatius was attending the winter formal, others were at a regular underground kegger at nearby Stern Grove Park. The theme this week, Wigga. That's the term for white kids who want to be black, who like the culture and the style. They didn't think they were being racist.
I asked for explanations from some of my friends. They were telling me, like, no, we're just making fun of white trash. And I was like, no, but, like, either way you put it, you're still making fun of a whole, like, culture. Like,
Luis wasn't there, but some of his friends were. 14 were suspended. They were mostly the ones who put pictures on social media.
And we have high expectations for our students, and we look at ourselves as really having an important role in the city to help deal with this. I think this is a national problem.
St. Ignatius is 55% white, 5% black. There were black students at this party. Over the decades, city Catholic schools have had a reputation, fair or not, of being privileged and insular. But student body president Lizzie Ford says things are changing.
If this were 30 years ago, we wouldn't have kids angry. We wouldn't have kids, 500 kids showing up in the theater to talk about this. And the fact that kids care about this, the fact that kids want to change this, that's what's different.
There are students here who think the suspensions were harsh. After all, it wasn't at school or during school hours.
Even though our students step off this campus, they still represent SI because they're educated by us. So that's why.
I'll tell you how complicated this issue is. I was talking to one of the parents of a black student here, and he thought the punishment was harsh because he says kids go to school here to get in prestigious colleges, and a suspension is going to hurt that. In San Francisco, Mike Sugarman, KPIX.
This is Sister Soldier. Public Enemy, security of the first world, and all aligned forces are traveling west to head off a white supremacist scheme to destroy the national celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. Public Enemy believes that the powers that be in the states of New Hampshire and Arizona have found psychological discomfort in paying tribute to a black man who tried to teach white people the meaning of civilization. Good luck, brothers. Show them what you got.
The situation that happened at Desert Vista High School right here in the Valley, where six girls, all white, decided it would be funny to take a picture, but they had letters on their sweater and they spelled out
"nigga"
the N-word.
Yeah, the shirts had individual letters and they all got together and said, if we line up this way from left to right, it spells out the N-word.
It
so
sure
let's
does.
Take a picture of it.
Yeah, and the story has gone national. One of the kids yesterday came out and said, "I'm sorry, I'm not a racist." Does this school, Desert Vista High School, does it have a race problem? And has it had a race problem? Well, joining us now is a former English teacher at Desert Vista. She left in 2014. We're going to find out why. There's a lawsuit, by the way. This former English teacher, her name is Dr. Cicely Cobb. Dr. Cobb, Mac and Gatos, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me on this afternoon.
Sure. When you found out about this picture, what was your reaction?
I actually was at home working from home that day. And I looked on my cell phone and noticed that there was a message on Facebook about Desert Vista High School. And since I am in a lawsuit, it immediately grabbed my attention. When I saw the picture, I literally screamed in my house, "Thank you, Jesus," for about 10 minutes.
Now, why would you scream that? That's a very interesting reaction.
I screamed it because, number one, I felt that I had harshly felt vindicated. I had been perceived in Ahwatukee for the past few years, especially once my lawsuit was announced on the news, as the crazy, angry black woman who had the audacity to accuse these innocent children of any wrongdoing. Because as was told to me on countless times during my tenure at Desert Vista High School, my nickname is C, and a former colleague of mine used to say, see, these are good children here at Desert Vista High School. So it must be you. You need to ask yourself what you are possibly doing wrong to cause these wonderful children to act in the way that they do. I felt vindicated because wonderful children, innocent children, collectively stand together to spell out the word, the N-word. And what I would like to add is this. We have focused so much on the Desert Vista 6. It's really the Desert Vista 7. I would like to know why there has not been more emphasis on who this photographer is.
Who took the picture?
Who took the picture? There's no doubt in my mind that this photographer knew what the N-word was. I taught at Desert Vista High School. We taught To Kill a Mockingbird, whether you were a freshman honors English student or just in general freshman English.
Okay.
They knew what the N-word was.
Okay.
Dealing with Atticus.
Dr. Cobb left Desert Vista, filed a federal racial discrimination lawsuit. It is still pending. She's been nice enough to join us. She left her job as an English teacher at Desert Vista in 2014. Obviously, we've been discussing what has happened at Desert Vista High School with the six girls, and now you bring up a good point, the seventh taking the picture, but six girls posing with letters on their chests, and it spelt out the N-word. Did you – now, this is what I heard, and you tell me if I'm wrong. Were you called derogatory names by children at Desert Vista High School?
Oh, yes, I was. The one incident that really stands out the most to me was on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning. I was crossing the street in Ahwatukee, 48th Street and Ray Road, and the students engaged in a one-sided Twitter war against me. And one student from Desert Vista High School took it upon himself to take my picture as he was driving, and he tweeted, Dr. Cobb cited working her corner. This is extremely racist and sexist in nature.
Working a corner like a hooker? Is that
like a prostitute?
All
so
right.
Regardless of all of my education, okay, I'm still the black whore who works her corner.
Did you also say that you were called something inside the classroom? Did they call you the N-word?
They did not call me the N-word in my classroom. What you saw on the news was basically, and it was the way that it was edited, they called my student, told me, one of my former students came to me, and this is what I would like to clear up from last night on ABC 15.
Okay.
One of my students, we had shown the movie Roots, me and my co-teacher, as part of the Junior English American Studies curriculum. And this male student said, Dr. Cobb, I'm really sick of these students. I don't play this. He was from a different state. He said this one white male student kept coming up to him going, hey, what's up, my N? And then he goes, oh, by the way, my name is Kuta Kente. He said, Dr. Cobb, it's like they made a mockery of you showing this movie Roots, and it's become a free-for-all with their racial comments towards me.
Dr. Cicely Cobb is joining us. She has a federal racial discrimination lawsuit against Desert Vista High School, the same high school where six senior girls lined up to spell out the N-word in a photo that's gone viral.
And Dr. Cobb, you're African-American. We should have said that probably at the beginning, because we're obviously talking about race there, and you had a lot of white children in your classroom. Some of them, you said, had called you certain words. Just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, It's tough to figure out why these kids are the way they are. But do you think there is a problem at the high school, or do you think that it's just a couple of kids that just don't know, or their parents haven't said, or they weren't raised the right way?
I would like to break this down because there are many problems here. Number one, there's a problem at home. These children have learned about that it was okay to use the N-word probably since they learned their first 20 words in their vocabulary.
But you don't know that.
That's my perception.
Okay. But you don't know. That's not really fair.
I'll say that. So my perception is I believe that this word is something that these students may be accustomed to using. One of the Desert Vista 6, her tweets are all over the internet on Facebook. She most definitely is very comfortable with using the N-word and thinks that blacks are far beneath her. So therefore, I don't believe, at least with this one Desert Vista 6, I don't believe that she is innocent by any means, and that she wasn't educated that the N-word is a horrific word to use. Also, do I believe that there's a racial issue at Desert Vista High School? Most definitely there is. There's been a racial issue with Desert Vista High School pretty much since the school opened.
Is it between students or is it between teachers and students?
It's the entire school.
So it's not African-American kids and white kids that can't get along or thrown back and forth. It's kids and teachers or faculty and kids that are having these racial problems.
Or is it white is it white against black? Is it not black against white? Is there not a racial issue the other way, too?
This is how I saw it from my perception. Most of the black students that I dealt with, I did not witness them deliberately doing anything to the white students that I interact with. I saw more of the friction, more of the instigation came from the white students instigating things with the African-American students.
You know, you also,
that's what I saw.
You also have the assistant superintendent there, Ms. Battle or Dr. Battle, saying that we're going to get rid of the N-word. Do you believe that? Do you think that this school can actually get rid of the N-word?
All I will say this about Tempe Union High School District administration is the following. Dr. Battle was the principal at the high school during my tenure. I went to Dr. Battle, as stated in my complaint, on multiple times about the racial issues that happened at Desert Vista High School. I would have loved for Dr. Baca, Dr. Battle, and Dr. Kevin Mendebell to have assisted me wholeheartedly with the racial issues on that campus. So I'll just say that I have to raise an eyebrow when I hear that Tempe Union High School District is going to assist Desert Vista High School, its parents and its students and its teachers, to spread the word to get rid of the usage of the N-word. I'm like, they were cognizant that the N-word was being used when I was at Desert Vista.
Okay.
They were cognizant of the racial issues I had. Why didn't they want to help me wholeheartedly then?
All right.
Now, all of a sudden, that it's hit national news, they've come up with this rather juvenile slogan to combat the issues that have wreaked havoc in Ahwatukee and across the state.
All right.
Dr.
Cobb, we appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much.
Dr. Cobb, I wanted to say, taught at Desert Vista, and it's interesting that she says, this was brought up before, and I brought this up before, and nothing was done. It's interesting she says, well, I don't know what they're going to do now and how they're going to handle it now.
She left her job as the English teacher at Desert Vista in 2014. She's got a lawsuit, federal racial discrimination lawsuit. Said it's been going on for quite a while, we'll watch the lawsuit. We'll see what happens. And we'll continue to talk about what happened at Desert Vista.
Right. 40 acres and a
mule, Jack. Right now, a high school principal is off the job, accused of making racially charged comments. Lakeside principal Jason Klein isn't talking publicly about the investigation, but this afternoon, some of his students are coming to his defense. Rebecca Schramm is live outside the school. And Rebecca, what are the students telling you?
Well, Kim, some support him, some don't. It's interesting, we were set up on the sidewalk earlier speaking with one student when the bell rang to change classes, and that's when several other students came up to us wanting to speak with us. It is the talk of the school ever since this letter went out from the superintendent saying the principal here has been removed and that he's under investigation.
I kind of find it hard to believe that he said that, but, I mean, if he did say that, you know, He's definitely in the wrong.
Did ousted Lakeside High School principal Jason Klein make a crude reference to slavery, as he's accused of saying in this flyer? The anonymous flyer says that in a meeting with janitors and security staff, Klein got mad and said, quote, "You don't want to mess with me. I'm a redneck master with a degree. I run these 40 acres."
Regardless of, like, if he, like, said the 40 acres part, it's like the redneck part kind of made it worse.
School district leaders won't talk specifics about the case, but several students rushed over to speak with us.
Is there a lot of tension in the school?
I mean, not really. Not today. It doesn't feel like it. Not like racial tension.
At least not in person.
Social media especially, there's been a lot of tension. There's two separate sides. Everybody kind of just thinks they know what's been going on, even without waiting for the investigation to unravel.
All these race comments are like you know, putting a real divide in the school.
I feel like the principal, Klein, is just this upstanding individual, and that I think he's getting an unfair shake here at Lakeside.
The school district is looking for a substitute principal as this investigation unfolds. The superintendent will only say that any violations of district policy or law will be prosecuted to the fullest extent. Live in DeKalb County, Rebecca Schramm, CBS 46 News.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race, so we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
The Citadel says it has finished its investigation into what some called racist pictures taken on campus. Leaders say photos taken in the days leading up to that night helped them to determine it was poor judgment and inappropriate, but not racially motivated.
It's not racism.
ABC News 4's Lindsay Maloney has her story.
Picture after picture of cadets dressed like toy soldiers, elves, and nutcrackers, taken in the days before one photo in particular made national headlines. A woman saw it on Snapchat and posted it to Facebook. It then went viral and is responsible for a change in what and how the Citadel educates cadets.
The investigation revealed that the cadets attempted to dress as ghosts of Christmas past.
In all, 14 cadets were punished for violating campus policies.
Those punishments are a spectrum based off of their level of involvement, not just with this incident, and not just because it was in a press, but continued violations of the rules.
But it's still not sitting well with Reverend Nelson B. Rivers III.
I can't imagine that somebody in that crowd didn't know what that was about. And if you knew what it was about, then you had ill intent.
Rivers and the National Action Network say they're pleased with the Citadel's response and have withdrawn the request for Rose's resignation.
We are now very pleased with his disciplinary action toward the cadets.
But they demand a change take place. One major change they want to see, the removal of the Confederate flag from the chapel.
Look, the time has come to take the flag out the same way you took it off the dome, in front of the building, and in front of the monument. Let's take it from inside of the holy place, quote unquote, here at the Citadel.
That was Lindsay Maloney reporting for us tonight. State lawmakers, of course, have to make that move to have the flag removed. Rosa said today that the punishments range from suspensions for three of the juniors, extra duties for the freshmen. He also announced the creation of a new task force that will work on advancing diversity. He hopes that will be ready by the fall.
Why haven't you learned anything?
First, I want to talk about the teachers that used an unapproved lesson in racism, and now they're completely under fire. They basically tried to segregate their classroom based on race, eye color, and things of that nature. Like, that's a good idea. And then they ran with it. And then, of course, young children go home, and what do? They talk. You know, you can never keep a child quiet. I think that's a Jared Fogel lesson that he learned the hard way and is still learning. But, you know, you sit there and you wonder, why are teachers doing this type of thing? I hate the idea of the activist teacher. Get out of the classroom, allow your views to be removed the moment you cross the threshold, and make sure you're just teaching 2 plus 2. I mean, that's all it really comes down to. This grand idea that you're now a part of a larger political discussion and you're trying to shape minds and create like little democratic voters in the future, just it really needs to stop. That is not what education is. That's not what education should be. And you need to remove that from the classroom.
Lachelle Bland wants her daughter to learn black history, but not by being discriminated against.
It's the craziest thing I've ever heard that a teacher did to teach a child something.
The principal of Mineola Elementary says the Tuesday after Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a first grade teacher here conducted an unapproved classroom experiment without notifying the school or parents. Kids aged 7 and 8 were segregated by eye color, then discriminated against for several hours.
That's awesome. I wish I could have watched that. I mean, yes, we're going to remove, if you have brown eyes, then we'll put you in one corner. If you have blue eyes, we'll go in the other corner. And the blue-eyed babies will get anything their heart desires. The brown-eyed ones will be treated like the excrement they actually are. I mean, that is, I wish I could have viewed that. That must have been awesome. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, where did it stop? I mean, what, they were yelled at, verbally abused? I mean, how were they abused? Like, that's what I want to know. I want to know what degree of racism are we talking about here? Are we talking pre-1950 racism? Are we talking after the civil rights movement racism? Are we talking 2016 racism where, you know, the blue-eyed kids are getting Oscars but the brown-eyed kids aren't? I mean, what kind of racism are we talking about, and what kind of lesson are we learning here? If we're going to learn about racism, I mean, are you going all the way? I mean, like, is this 12 years a slave? Like, what? Like, how bad is this going to be? And why the arbitrary number of just a couple of hours? I mean, why do this a couple? Make this a theme. Do it for a semester, right? I mean, make this a theme. It doesn't really sound like racism to me. It sounds like Nazism. So brown-eyed babies are discriminated and segregated and yelled at and ridiculed. But the blue eyes, well, you're cool. We like you. You're baby blue eyes. I mean, why would a teacher think that this is a good idea? Why is it that they think that segregating kids based on eye color and then treating one section of kids with brown eyes would be something that would teach a valuable lesson? I mean, why would they do that? I mean, is this outside the box, entertainment, engaging teaching? Or is this just like a sick sociopath that basically has always wanted to participate in a world of segregation and racism and targeted young kids, and every day he's looking at the brown-eyed one saying, God, I just hate you. I hate you and your brown eyes. Therefore, today we're going to learn a new lesson. And the lesson is me yelling at you and treating you like garbage because you have brown eyes. I'll wrap it around the idea that it's some sort of tutorial and that it's some sort of learning experience so you too can experience racism. But really, it's all about me. And it's all about me sitting there trashing you right to your face and getting away with it. I mean, why would they think that that's a good idea? 866-977-4820. When a teacher does something like this, don't you just automatically look at them and say, you got to go? I mean, you've got to go. There cannot be any room for activism education. I mean, there just cannot be any room for that. And the moment it pops up, the moment it steers itself, the moment it reveals itself, you have to shut it down and shut it down hard.
I have never heard you use the term white privilege. I was just wanted to ask you about that, why you don't use that term, and if you think that is an accurate term to describe what is happening in the system of white supremacy.
Because I prefer the term white supremacy. It's more specific and it describes more. See, it's not just privilege. Privilege kind of sounds like everybody's kind of more or less got a little something going for them. Supreme means I'm really in a position of power, not just something that somebody lets me do or, you know, that they got an option or something like that. Privilege kind of sounds that way. Supremacy is a stronger word. I prefer that word because it's more accurate.
Do you think white supremacy is a more accurate term to describe?
Oh, yes. Okay. Supreme, you know. It's just like the term Supreme Court. It means you can't go no further than this.
The one and only Macklemore, Ryan Lewis, and they didn't come alone. Give them a round of applause.
That's what's up.
Yeah, man. I think we could do that applause a little better. Let's give them a round of applause.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
How you guys doing?
I'm great.
One of the reasons why you guys are here today is because of this song that you released to the universe, if you will, that has all the social media buzz. People in the streets are buzz. People in the industry, they're buzzing about it too. I got a chance to hear it maybe about four or five times. And
right.
I even went to Genius too and, and downloaded the lyrics. I want to play this song right now. It's called White Privilege 2. And I want to come back and just talk about how it all began, how it all came together. Okay, Sway in the Morning. Sway in the Morning, Shade 4-5. That was White Privilege 2, recently released to the world. In my opinion, Heather,
mm-hmm.
One of the most powerful songs, impactful songs, honest songs, uncomfortable songs, songs that evoke all sorts of emotions
right.
that I've heard in an extremely long time.
Right.
The type of song that I enjoy
mm-hmm.
That forces people to think, whether they agree what was being said in the song or not, this is our world. This is our society.
That's Absolutely.
This is our country. This is our culture. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are here. They brought guests. I'm just curious. This is probably the bravest song you've ever had. I won't say that. You made a lot of courageous songs, but this is an extremely, brave song for you guys to make and write. Why? Why did you feel you don't have to do this? You got Grammys. You guys are rich now. You know, you sold a lot of records independently. You've been on world tours. Why do you even care to bring these topics about white supremacy, cultural appropriation, racism? Why was that important for you to talk about this?
For me, my art has always been a means of trying to dig into some sort of truth,
mm-hmm.
whether that was truth in myself, truth in society, using the page as a means to peel away the layers and try to figure this experience out that we call life. And that's a daunting process at times, but one that is the reason why I make art, why I write raps. And this was a record that was difficult. We watched, when we first met, we were an underground rap group,
mm-hmm.
and we obviously had a lot of success fairly quickly. Although we've been doing it for a long time, the success happened very fast. And there was a certain point in around 2013 where we had, I wrote this original record, White Privilege, now 10 years ago. And this was a very different moment. From that perspective, 10 years ago, I was looking at it from an outsider, from an observational point of hip hop has changed since I've been a fan of it. Who's coming to shows has changed since I started to go to shows. The mass consumer, what it looks like on television, the success of Eminem, the success of underground rappers that are white, everything is changing. I was looking at it from that perspective. Fast forward 10 years, here I am at the center of a conversation about race within hip hop, cultural appropriation, the Grammys, the process of who gets on the radio, who doesn't. And it felt necessary and very important for us to address that again.
Mm-hmm.
And to not shy away from that topic, but to step into the conversation and all of its inherent flaws,
mm-hmm.
All of my fear around, like, yo, what am I going to say now? It felt necessary.
We have these conversations a lot on this show.
Mm-hmm.
This is something, these topics are topics we've hit on for years, and it's falling on deaf ears. If it's falling on deaf ears, and I think it has a lot to do with the messengers. Because you can listen to Jasiri X, or you can listen to Kendrick Lamar, or different folks who have pretty much intertwined similar messages in their music as well, and it doesn't stick necessarily. It doesn't hold true, and definitely a lot of white people aren't listening to them say it. It coming from you is making white people listen as well to you say it. There's a certain ignorance that exists about white privilege with white people, in my opinion. When you speak to other white people, no blacks around, what is that conversation like? Do people understand that they're in this country or in this world, there is such thing as white privilege? Do they get that, or do you see a lot of ignorance to that as well?
I think that it depends on where you go.
Yeah.
I think in our community, a lot of people would understand the concept of white privilege, and it would end there in terms of recognizing it and then being silent and living comfortably within your privilege,
mm-hmm.
Which is what I think we've done for the last 2 years. So I think that this song was an attempt to participate in this conversation and try to do that in an authentic way. And sort of face the same white silence that we've been comfortable in.
Mm-hmm. Have you had conversations with other white folks? Just because we have conversations,
right.
We sit around and talk about it all the time with black folks. But
to me, that was the at the core of what this song is an attempt to open up a dialogue with the platform that we have to reach white youth.
Mm-hmm.
To have a conversation about race and put it out there. Because we can be silent.
Yeah.
We can sit back under the behind the veil of white supremacy and still be comfortable. But that's never going to change anything. And we had to step up. And I think there was a long period of time where we had where we're having success. And you know, as you mentioned, also getting critiqued with that success.
Yeah.
But I was silent. There is an epidemic happening right now with police brutality mm-hmm. and people of color in America, as there always has been. And I was silent. I didn't want to mess up. I didn't want to make it worse. Hmm. I didn't want to, I didn't want to say something that was wrong and then have that come back negatively to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is imperative for us as hip hop artists, as white hip hop artists, to step into the conversation in an authentic mm-hmm. way to engage a dialogue with white people. And that's what this song's intention was at the core.
Mm. Macklemore and Ryan, I was blowing up Sway's phone over the weekend when this song came out. And I already told you guys, once you walked in, I thought it was such a great show of social responsibility and personal accountability. And I didn't realize there was a whole legion of people who are on the offense with it. And I was looking at some tweets, and someone had put out 9 minutes of Macklemore apologizing for being Macklemore. And I was dissecting that, and I think it's because you're putting a spotlight on white privilege, and people are flipping that and turning it into white guilt.
Mm.
And so I'm wondering, in your opinion, what is white guilt? Is it something that you feel?
That's a good question. I think that this song starts out with me the night of the non-indictment mm-hmm. of Darren Wilson
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and feeling that frustration, feeling that anger, feeling that this is happening again and I can't believe it. And I was driving my car and I passed the police precinct in Seattle where they were starting to protest. Mm. And I drove past and I drove to a meeting. And I sat down in that meeting and I just felt like I needed to crawl out of my skin. I was just not comfortable in this place. I drove back, parked my car and got into the protest. That's where this song starts. And I think that for all in that moment, I felt out of protest practice. I felt like, who am I to be engaging in this? Am I going to cause more of a disruption being Macklemore in this moment? You know, we have news cameras there, like all of a sudden they find out that it's me and the cameras shift to me and it becomes about me when that's not why I was there at all. So the song walks the listener through that moment. In that second verse, I think that where probably people are getting the white guilt from, that's me unpacking baggage. That's me showing up to the protest and not knowing if this is actually benefiting anybody but myself. Like, why am I actually there? And it was important for me in this song to come from a real place. I think that if I just got on the microphone and started talking about white privilege, like, yo, I've read this book and that book and I know what's up, I've had these conversations, that's not inviting. I need mm-hmm. to come to that conversation how I felt, mm-hmm. which was hearing Black Lives Matter chanted for the first time and not knowing if that was okay for me to say. Mm-hmm. If I don't share that, maybe that is guilt. Maybe that is me unpacking or having this baggage I'm showing up to the protest in. But that's where I was at.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really get to a point of identifying with an audience if I'm coming in trying to point the finger and lecturing like I have it figured out, because I'm not an expert. I'm just attempting to participate.
Right. And then I think another part that people were really paying attention to is when you had mentioned Iggy and Miley and Elvis, and you are speaking about their use of cultural appropriation.
Right.
And some folks were like, well, what about you, Macklemore? Aren't you a cultural appropriator yourself? And I thought that maybe you did include yourself when you said, like, heisted the magic, but I don't want to interpret it. I'd rather, since you're here.
That whole verse is me implicating myself. Mm. And I think a lot of people have misinterpreted it, but it starts out with me saying, I'm in my own head, basically. And I had this internalized conflict and this internalized criticism that I've been hearing for the last couple years. And I'm going through my own thoughts. So it says, Ben, think about it. You've exploited and stolen the music, the moment, the magic, the passion, the fashion you toyed with. The culture was never yours to make better. You're Miley, you're Elvis, you're Iggy Azalea. We're all in the same place. We're all in the same sphere. Mm-hmm. We are white artists that in the last couple years have been rightfully critiqued as appropriating black culture and benefiting from it. So there is no difference in that regard. I'm putting myself in the exact same box as them. It was not intended to be a diss. It was intended to be to say that I'm exactly the same.
Right.
So then Ryan and Macklemore, so with in this world that we live in of everybody bragging about, oh, I ain't write shit. I just went into the studio and just spit it out. And the producer, yo, this just took 5 minutes. We kicked out the beat. This shit is fire. I'm all over the club with so many parts. Well, because I'm an artist as well, and I understand what it takes to make a brilliant record. I mean, bottom line, to what it takes to make a brilliant record. How long did it take to put this together, like all the pieces of it? How long did it take from start when you rode past the precinct that day till its completion?
Over a year.
Wow.
Over a year.
Mm-hmm. Over a year, and it would not have been possible without the community that we got with to make this record. And, you know, I would love to hear from them.
Yeah.
But it was very much a collaboration in the truest sense of the form, because if we're talking about having dialogues, if we're talking about listening, knowing when to step forward and when to step back, that can't happen just with me and Ryan.
Yeah.
That has to be a conversation. If we're talking about it's important to have dialogue, we need to be showcasing that dialogue on the record and in the process of making that record. And that's where, you know, I initially, after that, when did we first start talking? Probably after the night of the non-indictment, Hollis and I started talking, and we've collaborated on a bunch of stuff before. But that was when she first introduced me to some people in the movement in Seattle, Black Lives Matter movement, and started having dialogue. And that was, well over a year ago.
Wow.
Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are here. They brought guests. We're going to meet the guest up next. But we appreciate this dialogue. Sway in the Morning, Shay 4-5.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 30th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Feel free, chime in. Looking forward to hearing from victims of racism. You can share your thoughts. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We are fundraising 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Blog address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, you'll see the PayPal button top right corner of the page. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. Humongous thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported us over nearly 7 years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Helped you get a better understanding of what white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. Before I get to the line, if anybody has any thoughts, any parallels, since Macklemore is right here, Pacific Northwest, Seattle zone, any parallels between what you heard from him and our guest on Thursday, Professor Dorothy Bullitt, suspected, the word suspect isn't even there. Anyway, race soldier. She was here Thursday, and the conversation that he had, if folks heard that presentation, her performance on the cows, if there are any parallels that you see, because I strongly assert that there is, there are a lot of similar patterns in the way that white people that are here in this area, specifically Seattle, Washington, the way that they sound, the way that they present about racism, just the way that they conduct themselves in relation to non-white people in general. But if there are any parallels, feel free to share. This week there was a lot. There were so many things that went down this week I didn't even include, certainly with the confrontation in Oregon with the white terrorists there. This was the beginning of the Akai Gurley trial. He was the unarmed black male who was shot in Brooklyn, New York, at the end of 2014. Peter Liang, non-white male, so-called Asian officer who shot and killed him. That trial started this week. According to New York Daily News, there is one black person on the jury. That has been interesting, kind of keeping up with that in the news. That hasn't gotten very much attention either. Even Daniel Holtzclaw, saw where his name was removed from the registry in Oklahoma. I guess they keep a file of the folks who have committed crimes and all that stuff. His name was removed from the computer database this week, or at least it wasn't present. Many, many things that went down this week. It was hard to keep track, even the school thing. There were a lot more incidents that happened in school where young white urchins were showing that they are not very different at all from Cliven Bundy and Paula Deen and Donald Sterling and the geriatric generation of racism, white supremacy. If anything, the baton has been passed. The only quick comment that I will get, and I was even taking notes furiously as I was listening to the clips because so many things jumped out. The only thing that I will note, there was an omission. The piece on the Citadel where some of these students were disciplined. This was at the end of 2015 when they dressed up in these white outfits with the hoods on that looked like a Klan rally. It was not in the news report, but they had a separate article where they said that during their investigation, it was revealed that before they took the image, some of the white students present said, "Oh man, yeah, it looks like we're in a Klan rally here. Maybe, you know, maybe it might not be a good idea for, you know, us to do this or to post this." And they went ahead and did it anyway. And that was a part of why that some of the students got more severe punishments, because it was recognized pretty immediately what it looked like and what this represented, particularly at this institution that has a long history of this type of blatant, explicit white supremacist conduct. I thought that was really important because that got left out of the clip. And I guess the other quick one that I would get in, with all of the hoopla around Nate Parker's film that was at Sundance this week, The Birth of a Nation, the biopic on Nat Turner, I did confirm Amy Goodman was there for the entire week. She did not discuss this film at all. And it was widely reported that this was the most talked about film at Sundance. It broke the record for the most money paid for a film that was presented at Sundance all time. She did not mention this film at all. And she talked about a lot of different projects, talked about racism with people that were there. My BFF on her job, again, suspected race soldier. The other part, Fox Searchlight, the company that bought this film, $17.5 million. I think that that is extremely significant because this is the same Rupert Murdoch conglomerate, the folks that bring you Wall Street Journal and Fox News and all that. But these are the same folks, this massive empire that brought us outstanding content like Martin and 12 Years a Slave, Empire. I think that that is hugely significant, that this is a part of the same organization that has purchased this film. I think that should be kept in mind as, you know, we move forward as this film comes out. With that, we will hit folks who dialed in. No metaphors for the Saturday program. No metaphors for the Saturday program. No metaphors for the Saturday program. That's something I try and make sure I'm not engaged in myself. Just frequently when people are using metaphors and making comparisons, the things that they compare are not related at all, they present inaccuracies. People don't make the same connections. You just want to try to be as clear and as explicit as possible when we're sharing our views on what racism is or what we think about, you know, whatever topic that it is you're going to address. No metaphors on the Saturday program. If you could watch the background noise, that would be greatly appreciated. If everyone could share one time your view, say what you want. Just be cognizant there are other folks who also are on the line who would like to share. If you could share one time and then allow everybody else to get their commentary in. And then if you have other comments that you want to get in, we'll see if we have time where you can, you know, add your additional commentary as we go. Thank you kindly, everybody who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Gus, my brother.
Please do not call me brother. I've said that for many years on the program. We can hear you, though, sir.
My apologies. I'm calling in relation to Dr. Bullock. Actually, I lived in Seattle for 12 years, and I've experienced women similar. I had a question. Did she say her former mate was he lived in a project previously? I believe I heard that.
I think that's accurate.
And it just, well, we all know that there's a term related to white people that engage in sexual activities with black people who are poverty stricken. I just wanted to mention that, and thanks for the show.
All right, on. Appreciate that. Appreciate that. First time caller. Are you a first time caller, sir?
Yes, I am.
Right on. Great. Always glad to hear from first time callers. Hopefully, if you said you didn't have anything else right now, if we have time, you can get in any of the comments or observations that you have, particularly about, since you have lived in this area, if you have anything else you want to share about that or relations, as I said, to Macklemore and what you heard from Dr. Bullitt. Good to hear from you, though, sir.
You as well.
For sure, for sure. All the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do you all have commentary?
Hey, Gus, can I be here?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just had a question. I've always been curious about, you call Amy Goodman your BFF. I was just curious of what you meant by that. If you don't want to tell me, that's fine, but I was just wondering.
That is not a problem. BFF acronym, best friends forever. I'm just.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Are you hearing me? Okay.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay. BFF is an acronym, best friend forever. That is just my one moment where I'm being a little silly, in terms of just a little, as I said, being a little silly. That's saying that she is my best friend forever. I think I've been pretty explicit on this program as well as online and saying consistently that I think that strongly she is an extremely dangerous racist in her presentation, her performance on Democracy Now! And other outlets where she goes to talk about racism directly, indirectly, that I think she is extremely dangerous and I cannot stand her. I think I've said that pretty bluntly before, so I've just been playing around saying BFF here and there sometimes when I reference her.
Oh, okay, I'm a new listener, so I thought it meant something else, something different.
Oh, right on.
but I did have one thing to say.
Yes, sir.
I did have one thing to say. In my home city, this is the guy. I've been working with the Bernie Sanders campaign, but I took a break. I don't think I'm going back. I took a long break, but I got work and school and stuff. But I did have one thing to say about the Flint water crisis. It's a city right next to me, a sister county, Pritchard, and my whole life, like I got a whole bunch of family members over there, and my whole life they tell me about how the water's been dirty and stanky and never drink the water, and I think this is kind of like widespread. I don't think it's only in Michigan or Flint. I think it's everywhere, because got people in Ohio talking about the water. I think this has been going on way, way longer. I don't know about lead in particular, but it's definitely not something new. And I think people need to look into that a little bit more, man, because we've been bathing in this water and all type of stuff. But, yeah, I mean, since a little kid, I remember running water, you know, inside glasses, and you can't even see through the water. I thought everybody knew about that. I didn't even know that was a new phenomenon. I thought everybody knew that had poor water in the hood and in the ghettos. And, but that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, for sure. Great point. And they, I know the Washington Post, and I think it was some other outlets, they said the exact same thing. They called it an infrastructure problem, where the water is bad, the pipes or what have you, they need to be replaced. It's leaching chemicals or lead into the water, whatever other poisons and toxic chemicals. And particularly, as you said, where a lot of black people are, particularly if they're black people that don't have a lot of resources, but that is very widespread. They were making the same point that you just said and just giving a lot more detail around that, but saying that this is absolutely not something that is isolated to Flint. And I don't see any evidence that there's going to be any massive effort on the part of whites to invest in correcting this problem on a widespread basis anytime soon.
You get it.
For sure. Yes, sir. Thomas in New York. We can hear you.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Can I be heard clearly?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. I have a few observations. One was on the Ty Gurley shooting. You know, other than Chicago and Los Angeles, no other cities in the country have more people than New York has black people. I mean, they have almost 3 million. And it's funny how they could have only one black person on the jury. You know, that's definitely done intentionally. Back when we was reading Ben Tillman, I was constantly referencing him to Donald Trump. And I just wanted to say, you know, I was cracking up. I think it was yesterday or maybe the day before, but he called Ted Cruz an anchor baby. You know, just in case you thought you was white, bro, he's still a Cuban. Letting them know. The Flint situation, I think that's, you know, chemical warfare, but it's also psychological. You know, when you're living in a city on a state next to one of the largest bodies of natural water in the whole world, and you guys get terrible water, that has to be a psychological thing that they're doing. The clip where the guy was talking about the book, George Washington having his slaves looking like they were really happy in the situation they were in. He said that he started teaching his son at 7 by using the book and the images and asking his son, you know, how would you feel to be black? Which meant his son already had an idea that it was a difference between black and white already at 7. And the host went on to say, man, I started at 3. You know, I was teaching my daughter at 3 years old. So, you know, they teach them early. I love your segue from the Obama talking about how this generation is better, followed up by at least 5 stories of white terrorism in schools, but that was excellent. I won't go through all the stories. It's just typical behavior. But one story that in particular I love was that teacher from Desert Vista High School. She was just excellent, man. I loved her. I hope she wins her lawsuit. She was definitely terrorized. That principal's comments, those were epic. You know, he's the master of the plantation, you know. Oh, just epic, man. The Citadel, they weren't dressed like the Klan. They were just being the ghosts from Christmas past. Oh, man, that's just beautiful. And they removed the Confederate flag from everywhere except for the church on the campus. Epic. That the guy was clowning the commentator with the segment about the segregation based on eye color. You know, he made it very clear that he doesn't want lessons about justice in the classroom at all. As for what you were saying earlier, you know, you said that you guys are very refined. Those white people up by you are very refined. And Macklemore, very refined. He's very good at what he does, and I really hate him. And he's to me the flip side of admitted racist Eminem, who was the first, you know, white to sign to a major label. But he didn't get the treatment of blacks. You know, he actually got paid what he was supposed to. He actually got a good deal where they weren't putting him in perpetual debt. And Macklemore, coming out as an independent artist, he doesn't have to pay for airplay. He doesn't have to market himself like, say, a Master P had to when they were doing an independent thing. So it's keeping a lot of money in his pocket. And also, Eminem also made similar references in his songs to Elvis, how he was stealing rock, like he's stealing hip-hop, sort of like they're bragging to me. Lastly, the ongoing trend I got from all of these together is, and this really is even going on in Brazil, so it's just ongoing trying to get them codified behind what they're posting on social media. That's what I'm getting from this. They're really making an advocate effort to tell white people, listen, you know, this is unacceptable. We're not going to accept this, so y'all better stop doing this because, you know, we won't be able to help you if you do. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I just want to get in real quickly. Dr. Cobb out in Arizona, outstanding example of black self-respect. In my illustration the whole time, I was like, man, we'd love to get her as a guest on the program, but I don't want to mess her lawsuit up because I know white people, we've had guests before who've come on where they have pending litigation, and white people did listen to the program, and that even got brought up as the case moved forward. So I don't want to mess her suit up. Maybe after it's all over, we can reach out. But outstanding illustration of black self-respect. I even had notes on the way that they, I guess I will say really quick, the white people that were talking to her, Mac and Gatos, people who listen to the compensatory call-in, you have heard them before. It's KTAR in Arizona. Anytime something related to racism happens, I try to go there so we can have like a consistent source to see how these whites present about these topics. You heard them, the situation with Dr. Ursula Orr that happened, the black female professor in 2014 that was slammed on the ground. They had the dash cam video where they said she kicked the officer, and he threw her on the ground. And we had Reverend Maupin on the program, who was also working with these little racist students who did the nigger on the shirt thing, where he went on their program, and they were fussing at her and saying that she was wrong, and this white race soldier didn't do anything wrong, and you all are beating up on him, and this has absolutely nothing to do with racism. But Reverend Maupin came on that program and said that that white guy who slammed her said that he told him that he would not have done this if Dr. Orr had been a white person. So you've heard them before. You can kind of, if you recall, you can kind of compare and contrast the way that they consistently talk about these issues in Arizona. Anybody else that we have not heard from, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello to everybody. I hope your evening is going well. Gus, every time you say Amy Goodman is your BFF, I chuckle amazingly because I don't know if you know this. Several years ago, a colleague of Cynthia McKinney's named Michael Rupert, he since passed away, he uncovered, actually, should I say, that Democracy Now! Was getting a financial stipend from one of Rupert Murdoch's foundations. So I'm not sure how that worked, but, you know, Democracy Now! Used to be on Pacifica, and it was able to find some outside financing, which allowed it to move away from Pacifica, even though it is technically still part of them. But that was uncovered, and so it does not surprise me, you know. And after years of listening to Democracy Now! And a year or so of listening to The Cows, I do see definitely some racism which comes up, which whether or not she's conscious of it, it doesn't matter. It's there. About the Flint water crisis, I've been conducting some major research on it because it seems to get worse. Every time when I try to turn away from it, it just gets worse. And this week I found an article which was verified by several other articles which laid out the criminality of what actually happened in Flint and the amount of money which the emergency manager and hence Governor Snyder said they would save over a 10-year period by switching to the Flint River water and then switching to this new pipeline was about $15 million. However, Detroit, their water authority had offered them a contract which would have enabled them to remain on the Detroit plan at a cost that would have saved them over a 30-year span over $800 million. So the Flint water crisis, honestly, to me, is starting to look a little bit like eugenics or something along those lines. Because if it was not for the results coming out of Virginia Tech, I'm pretty confident nothing would have been done. So that would have meant the people would have been poisoned more, and of course, death would have most likely deaths would have increased. So that's it's a horrible situation. The many clips which you play each week to demonstrate the racism within this newer generation has completely ripped my eyes open. Just completely. Small little details which I didn't see in my own personal interaction with young people stand out significantly now. And the things that my little nieces and nephews say, which all of my nieces and nephews are mixed. I don't have a single pure black niece and nephew in my family as of yet. Everything that they say to me, you know, they're all mixed, but the majority of them have horrible self-esteem, horrible self-confidence, and horrible self-worth. Particularly, my oldest niece, who is 17, she hates, and she has literally told me this, she hates the brown in her skin. Hates it. And when I've sought to understand why, come to find out, her friends are not as open and accepting as we have been led to believe. So they will say little things about her hair, which is absolutely beautiful, or little things about her nose because she has a black nose, or her ears, or her hips, because she has black hips. And these little things she will say to me, she'll say, oh, but they were just playing, they were just playing. And I tell her, of course, they're not just playing. You need to really stay away from them. And, you know, she's 17, so she doesn't necessarily listen to me now. But I'm seeing this repeated over and over again. And I was listening to a speech by Chris Hedges, actually. I try to be what white people would call diverse in my opinion so I can understand where white people are coming from and where black people should go to avoid those streams. And Chris Hedges tried to point out some of this, and he doesn't do a very good job of it often, but particularly when it came to violence and the history of white vigilante violence. And he didn't make the connection as I often do, which white emotional vigilante violence was a precursor to white vigilante physical violence. And with my nieces and nephews, I see a lot of the emotional violence. So it does not give me hope that that's not going to spur some physical violence when the economy goes further into recession and probably depression, which a lot of the numbers, not only in the United States, but globally are suggesting. But that's for another day. So thank you for the incredible, incredible show. I have yet to listen to the two previous ones from earlier in the week, but I cannot wait to hear them. Peace, everybody. Have a great night.
Appreciate that. I can just say really quick for the younger white people, it could have been more because they really showed out. The white millennials, 21st century white urchins, they really showed out over the past 7 days. It could have been more. Can't play everything, but it could have been much more from just this week, just the past 7 days. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have comments you want to get in if we have not heard from you yet?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys and to all the callers. I was listening to that racist rant clip, and I found it to be really hilarious, just the way, just how blatant they are. And I think, just like the previous caller said, the sheer number of incidences with so-called young white people, I think just really should bring it home that nothing has really changed. What I'm noticing is that white people, the younger white folks seem to be less refined, and I think it's because there's so many different overt actions of white supremacy that come on television every day, whether it's Donald Trump saying something crazy or anyone else for that matter. There's so many public incidences. And then also when you combine that with the public incidences of blacks being murdered on camera just repeatedly, I think it gives them a carte blanche kind of an attitude in regards to how they deal with racism, white supremacy. So they're much less refined from what I'm seeing. And I think as time progresses, they're going to become much less refined as time progresses. Also, I think it kind of brings home again that white people are racist no matter what age they are. I remember listening to a clip with Dr. Welsinger, and she was speaking about an experiment where they had like white children that were as young as 3 years old that basically when they asked, you know, who was the bad person, they immediately pointed to black. Who they didn't like, they immediately pointed to black. Just everything that had to do with anything negative, they immediately pointed to black. She said, no hesitation. This was I'm now listening to the 26th episode that she was on. So I think it's either the 25th or this one, the 26th. I think it's this one. No, I think it's the last one, the 25th. But, yeah, it was just the way she described the experiment and just how these children as young as three instantly understood that black was bad in every way, shape, or form just kind of speaks to what you've been playing recently. And then for the Desert Vista High School clip, I think her name was Dr. Cobb. I wish her all the best, and I'm glad that she got the evidence she needed in such a profound way as far as these white females, white terrorists acting up and spreading their terrorism online and thinking that it was funny. And I found that in that clip, the reporter or whoever the reporter was practicing heavy racism. I found it very interesting that at one point in the clip, he said, it's hard to figure out why these kids are that way. Is it an issue at home or the school? And I'm just like, you're asking a really stupid question simply because the entire society is this way. And these kids are just a reflection of a micro reflection of what the macro problem has always been. And just for him to even present it in that way, I find it to be very racist and just white supremacist in his approach to even asking the question when we know that that's just the foundation of America and the heartbeat of America is racism, white supremacy. And then the clip with the racist principal, I found that one very interesting, too. Again, it's just lack of refinement. I think they're becoming less refined, certain ones anyway. The more intelligent ones, the ones that are educated, that are professors, tend to be more refined. But the younger ones I'm finding to be much less refined. And then I found it interesting in that clip, too. There was a young white male that actually came to the principal's defense, which, again, shows that these white kids have staunch support for their racist elders and all, you know, and all things that they choose to do. And then for the Citadel clip, I found the section, the most fascinating thing was where they discussed having the Confederate flag in the chapel. And it just speaks to, you know, racism, white supremacy being the religion of white people. You know, you have to mix the murder, terrorism, and genocide of black people with the worship of white Jesus. They're just a marriage, you know, a marriage made in heaven for white people as far as that's concerned. And then with the Nat Turner clip, what I'm going to keep my eye out for is to see how they've watered down the story or what they do to try and infuse some form of either the weakening of his legacy or some form of racism, white supremacy in the way in which they present him. So I'm going to definitely be taking a look at that as far as that's concerned. And with Macklemore, I find him to be a highly, highly refined racist suspect. I think that he is a part of the mass confusion. He's like a rap version of Tim Wise. I think that he knows exactly what he's doing. He makes that crystal clear. Then with you speaking, when you were speaking about the comparison between him, because he's from the Seattle area with Dorothy Bullitt, I think from the different guests you've had from that area, that they seem to be highly refined and highly educated in the terrorism of Black people. In a lot of ways, they're used to being worshipped, and they're used to dealing with non-white people in the way in which they're held in high regard and revered. So whenever they come across people who do not hold them in high regard and who will call them to task, essentially they become uncomfortable. And like with Ms. Bullitt, she became much less refined as the show progressed. And I know you described a couple of the other guests from the Seattle area that were much less refined as the show progressed as well. And I believe it's because there's a certain arrogance that white people carry, especially those that are highly educated on the terrorism of Black people. There's a certain arrogance that they carry, and they only want you to go as far as they want you to go. And that was why I was saying from the beginning, she was practicing racism from the very beginning, just by not wanting the public forum as far as callers calling in to ask questions. That was a way of her taking control, and racism, white supremacy is about domination and control. So from the very beginning, she was practicing racism, just doing that, and it just progressed as the show went on. And thank you for taking my call. I'll mute my line there.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. With the Macklemore.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, with the Macklemore issue, like, he got to be practicing racism, because I can think of a million things you can be doing more constructive to combat racism than making a 5-6 minute song, about your privilege or whatever that means, you know. So I mean, like, I know he's smarter than that. I know he can run through a million things he can be doing worth more of his time. But I wanted to make a comment about the young racists these days, and about wanting to use the N-word. I think folks need to step back and just look at the entire, like, situation, debate, or what have you, and just, like we know they use it at their homes, around their family members or friends, you know, their white buddies. We know that, you know, when they're not around Black people, so it just comes down to they want to be able to use it in front of Black people or with Black people. Like, that's what the whole thing is about. They want to be able to call me as a Black man a nigga. So we just going all the way back again to the same thing. So, you know, that's all I want to say about that. It's just racism. I'm mute my line.
Yes, sir. Any folks that we have not heard from, metaphors, did hear a few. No metaphors for the Saturday program. Just be explicit about what it is you want to say. Anyone we have not heard from, feel free to hop in.
Can I be heard?
Feel free to speak, please. Yes, sir.
Yes. I also noticed, like, when he was comparing the one suspected racist who was going on about the whole blue-eyed experiment, I noticed that, like, when he was comparing all the racism, when he got to the 2016 one, he brought up the Oscars and kind of neglected the ones that you could even say that been in the past, like, 3 months. Like, this big act of racism. And I know the same with the George Washington one with the report. At the end, they just had this huge deflection onto, like, the whole gender thing. And also, I just want to know, I'm just scared for the Nat Turner movie, too, if Fox got it. I'll be off. Peace.
I know. Other folks that have not spoken yet, if you had commentary you wanted to share, feel free.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Oh, okay. Greetings to Gus and to all the callers.
Your volume is a little low. Volume is a little low.
Can you hear me better now?
That is an improvement.
Okay, I'll try to speak a little louder. Greetings to everybody. I'm just called the ingredients to Gus. I just wanted to
add on to some of the things that folks have been saying so far, particularly after concerns, you know, obviously, you know, racism.
Your volume dropped again. Like, use your full black self-respect voice. Try to speak up as much as possible.
Okay, can you hear me now? Is it better?
Yes, if you can stay at that level right there.
Okay, great. Like I said, greetings. I just wanted to add on to some of the things that have been being said as far as the racism from younger white people, particularly that picture from the high school of the people, of the white females who were lined up together to spell out the word nigger, and just trying to really look at some of the nuance and the detail of, like, the facial expression of the white females and how that really tells a picture, tells a story of just how, you know, insidious white supremacy is in their brain computers and how they function. You know, we all the conversations around, you know, the one female came out to the rally or something like that, and, you know, she apologized, and she had some black people flanking her, and, you know, that sort of thing is just, you know, when I came into, you know, the understanding, a greater understanding of racism, white supremacy, you know, obviously impacted greatly by Dr. Frank Presswell's thing, also Neely Fuller Jr., and really, you know, trying to understand the science of how they function. And one of the ways in which I do that when I move throughout the world, and I do live in a community that is predominantly white, and my profession is one in which I, you know, am teaching white college students, you know, in just understanding the intricacies of the ways in which they practice racism, how they understand themselves in relationship to a black person. So when I see those facial expressions of these females aligned in the picture, that the story of their faces is very intricate, very detailed, and very simply how white supremacy is functioning, how they are ingesting it, how it is probably, you know, part of the very definition of who they are as people. And so what I've come to do in these last, you know, 5 or 6 years, and I've really been sort of trying to scientifically understand white supremacy and really looking at the details of what's going on. You know, you begin to sort of categorize certain kinds of white people, and I think that as black people, you know, because of the racism, we need to be doing more of that. I'm not suggesting that anybody online is not doing that. What I'm saying is that in general, I think we need to be doing more of that, really cataloging them, where you have a Macklemore kind of a white person, or a Hillary Clinton kind of a white person, or a Timothy Wise kind of a white person. Like, it's really important, you know, and I'm really trying to, you know, speak to Frank Smith Walton's understanding of the notion of playing chess, various pieces of the board, having various identities and various personalities, but the goal is to, on the white side of the chessboard, the goal is to sack the black king. And, you know, so when I see those images, like the one with these females at the high school, or the rant that you played earlier, which I had no idea about, I just heard tonight on the program, where you have this explicit kind of demonstration of the white mind, it really pushes me to want to really, you know, put in a lot more effort to categorizing particular kinds of white people. Because although you have particular kinds of white people, so for Macklemore, for example, you have, you know, his voice. You know, he sounds very apologetic, sounds very tender in his discussion of white privilege, which is problematic in and of itself. And, you know, he's on a program talking to black people, and you can even hear in the black people's voices that he's talking to how they're sort of gently kind of, you know, handling him. because here we have this white person who is willing to speak openly, or ostensibly it seems willing to speak openly about white supremacy. And so what I'm paying attention to is like the inflection of like Macklemore's voice, the way he speaks, the way he's sort of talking about this very terroristic problem, you know what I'm saying, in a very watered-down kind of fashion, because he's not really talking about white supremacy. And not only is he not talking about white supremacy, he's not talking about what should be done with black people or what white people need to be doing in order to eradicate the situation. It's just this movement, you know what I'm saying, if we're in a new refined stage of white supremacy, it seems to me that we're going to have a lot more of these white people coming out in positions of, you know, of entertainment, you know, music and or actors or things like that, who are coming out and who are admitting and saying, yes, I am, you know, part of this. I'm indicting myself, you know, as Macklemore said, or I forget the particular word that he said, you know, he's indicting himself, he's putting himself out there. But it seems to me the function of that is to play on the victimization of the black person who is so, lived a life being a victim of racism. And one of the effects of that is to find the white person who is not a racist. And I think that these particular kinds of refined white people like Timothy Wise and like Macklemore, and the list is long, I think that these, obviously, as has been said many times on the program, are very dangerous, dangerous, dangerous white people. And they represent the future of the way in which I think white supremacy is going to function rhetorically. That is the language that is going to be, how it's going to be presented to the masses, and I mean by masses of black people, in order to get them to acquiesce, in order to get them to remain docile, you know what I'm saying, in context and relationship to, just on a very simple level, the way they sound. Literally, the tone of their voices, regardless of what they are saying, the tone of their voices, you know, being around a lot of white people, and I've lived around a lot of white people for a very long time, you know what I'm saying, being in a position of, you know, authority that a white person gave me in the classroom, and just, you know, moving throughout the community and being among white folks in general, the ones who purport themselves to be the ones who understand, yes, racist, white supremacy, I get it, you're absolutely correct. And I have had many conversations with white people, who are very willing to talk about white supremacy now, which, let's say, 10 years ago, Gus, was not the case. Now it seems like it's almost, it's chic. It's almost, you know, in fashion for particular kinds of white people to talk about it. Not because they're interested in solving the problem on their end, but because they're interested in putting forth a rhetoric, using language, songs, metaphors, what have you, using this kind of rhetoric, not to solve the problem, but to really try to seduce even further, or contribute to the long seduction of the black mind, so that you know, we have to separate who the bad white people are from the good white people. But none of these people have written any kind of, as far as my research has gone, has said anything, has written anything, has sang any songs, has rapped any verses, you understand what I'm saying, has put pen to paper, who has typed anything that is a kind of a how-to to prevent, to revoke, to rebuke white supremacy in and of itself. It's one thing to say, yes, the sky is blue, the sun is yellow, and another thing entirely to not want to do anything about it, or not put forth anything in your so-called art to change the situation from happening. And I think that it's just, you know, manifested in just the tone of their voices. And not only that, this is the last thing that I say. As I move throughout the community in which I live in, and I investigate and watch white people just moving up and down the street, eating their food, buying their groceries, doing whatever it is that they do. You know what I'm saying? While black lives, you know, while black people are being murdered and killed and destroyed, and the very nature of what it means to be black and the notion of black is being absolutely subverted, continuing to be subverted, everyone seems to be absolutely okay with it. No one seems to be distressed. No one seems to be upset. But they do want to, they want to pet the black person who speaks directly about white supremacy to them. And they want to use language and the tone of voice for the purposes of I have some proof to simply continue high levels of deception. And it seems to me my analysis of the culture in which, you know, the thing I find myself present in at this time, and I look around, I see that's what's going on. A new code, a new way to play chess. We're going to redefine what it means for the rook to move here or the knight to move here.
Lots of metaphors. Lots of metaphors.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And so, finally, all I want to say is that it's important to really pay attention to the tones of their voices. And I think that's always an indication, even sometimes regardless of what they are saying, but the way in which they're saying it. They don't seem to be upset. If this is a problem they care about, this is a problem that they think needs to stop. They seem to be lacking a certain kind of passion in order to solve the problem. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Appreciate that. I think some other folks have talked about the tone that whites use when they either when they come on this program or just, you know, wherever they hear these folks speaking at. But the last point that you made about they don't sound particularly angry. I think I've asked an admitted racist on this program before. And while she was saying that she was, you know, so angry and enraged about white supremacy, she was giggling, and I think that has been repeated consistently in terms of people just paying attention to the way that they sound when they are talking about white terrorism, this war that whites are waging against black people especially. Anyone that we have not heard from, if you could speak up now. We have about 10 minutes before we get to workplace racism. You should speak up right now.
Can I be heard?
Caller in New York, feel free.
Yes. Good evening, Gus. I'll be brief. I read the post that you put on Facebook regarding Daniel Holzkor, and I'm a little bit confused. Now, has he disappeared from the registry with regard to the PRISM system altogether, in that, you know, we just don't know where he is? He could be just sitting home chilling with his fancy ankle jewelry, or is he, like, off of the sex offenders list?
I will go to KFOR just to see exactly what they have reported on this. So they have, and this is from yesterday, Daniel Holzklaw has disappeared from the Oklahoma Department of Corrections website. The former Oklahoma City police officer was convicted of raping, and they didn't say black women, but black women while on duty. He was sentenced to 263 years in prison. The website, which shows criminal convictions, mugshots, and where inmates are incarcerated, has deleted Holzklaw. When asked where Holzklaw is located, Oklahoma Department of Corrections spokesperson Terry Watkins would only say, "We are not going to comment. It is a matter of security." KFOR inquired if Holzklaw is still in custody, and Watkins assured us he is. Alex Jerzeswick, I'm hoping I'm getting that right, told KFOR anchor reporter Ali Meyer he was processed at Lexington exactly as every other offender. Currently, we cannot review his location for security, the security of the inmate, and the facility. Mm-hmm. And then they have a photograph of what they did have for Holzklaw as of Tuesday, and that information has been deleted. If you go there, you'll see the screenshots of what used to be mm-hmm. there when you went to his site that showed a picture of him and then all the charges and everything, and then all of that is gone when you check the site as of yesterday. Mm-hmm. So I don't have... I, oh, go ahead.
I did I did see that, and I also thought I saw that they have not informed any of the victim's attorneys as to any changes in his, you know, status or where he's been. So I was just wondering whether or not that's like a violation of their rights, because as victims, they have the right to know exactly where that man is. I thought that was like a standard thing across the board with regard to anybody who commits a sex crime, because they automatically in a registry and the victims are notified as to where their whereabouts are. So I just also thought that, you know what, and I hate to be like, you know, I'm a victim of racism. This was like such a great victory that it was almost too good to be true. I don't know if anybody else felt that way. Unfortunately, I did. And I thought that they were going to flip this with regard to the appeals. I thought everything was going to come out in the appeals. Oh, you know, yeah, that this testimony and that testimony. They were going to find all these holes there. I had no idea that they were going to do this. But the lesson in this to me is that just as they erased him, they can erase me. They can erase anybody at any time. You know, that person never had a house. What house? She doesn't have a house. What mortgage? Just erase it. Social Security number? Never existed. Who is that? Bank account? In a flash. So that's what I took away from that. But I really hope it all turns around for those victims. With regard to the Citadel, I was not surprised by any of that. I don't think I mentioned this before on the show. Back in 1985 or 86, a young man who went to the Citadel by the name of Kevin Neesmith, a good friend of mine, was terrorized. They thought some cadets lit a cross in his room or something like that, set a cross on fire in his room. Anyway, he transferred to South Carolina State, and that's how he and I became friends. And he handled that. I had no idea that that was him, that he never mentioned it. And I think he had a relative that was on a board of directors or something at the Citadel. It didn't even matter. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And with regard to Macklemore, I have never heard one song that he's ever done. I'm like an old school hip hop person, so I don't even pay attention to these folks, especially the white ones that come out. I really didn't even pay attention to MC Search and Third Base, none of them. But it would be interesting, I thought, for him to be asked that question that you asked all the guests, that Mr. Coates asked in his article, are whites greatly pained, sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but not enough? I would love for him to answer that question. I don't think that he is refined, but I don't think that Macklemore is refined enough to really process that question, to have it match up with exactly what he's supposed to be talking about with this white privilege thing. That's just me. I could be incorrect, but I don't think he's savvy enough to handle something like that. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. The president, I believe comment that he made, I'm going to go by counter racist codification and at this time and say that he said what he said, but I would be curious for him to elaborate on what he meant about what he was saying, something in regards to his kids and the kids that in and around his children's age are better at the subject of racism. Maybe in the future when he is no longer president, you get the opportunity to have him come on the program to be able to explain that. That'd be quite interesting. From the standpoint of white people and the name calling, I would suspect that most of us who are listening understand, even with white, without white people calling us names or the other displays that I would say is their means of bragging about the system of racial white supremacy, it still would exist. It still would exist. They have the system of racism and white supremacy has so many tools, and I'm not even talking about the weaponry that they have in place to destroy us and other white people who are not in agreement in how to maintain the system of racism and white supremacy. Tools such as laws. The means that they can, in their tool belt, change things with however and whenever they want to most efficiently practice the system of racism and white supremacy. White people, the last thing I'm going to say is white people under the system of racism and white supremacy, other than coming to us to tell us, they have one objective in their contact with us is to tell us on how the system works and how to destroy it. Or to go about the means for themselves without even coming to us and destroying it themselves, meaning some sort of level of revolutionary suicide to actually wage war against other white people. That's their only place. That's just logic. I think I'm going from a level of logic. Is what the relationship that they should have with their non-white victims. So to the white male who I think I'm hearing is a rapper. I don't know anything about the person myself. You know, all of that. And I've heard it countless number of times in different variations. His case, making some sort of rap or whatever. No. I'm not even listening to it as far as that concerned. You know, and that's basically all I have to say. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Anybody that we have not heard from, if you have comments that you want to get in, we have about 3 minutes before we get to workplace racism, so you'd have to be pretty concise with whatever it is you want to say.
Can I be heard?
I heard two Hello? People. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm going to be really quick. Just a quick thing about the book discussion, speaking of metaphors, I do find that it's a typical white supremacist tactic to bring up gender and the way they discuss gender as men and women are perceived differently. That's historically false because we know that black people, in spite of gender, have been viewed differently, especially through gender. You can even look at the way Serena Williams and Caitlyn Jenner is described. Caitlyn Jenner as a transgender woman can be seen, is demanded to be accepted as more womanly than someone who has biological female traits like Serena Williams. I mean, plenty of that. And another white supremacist tactic that I observed is when that 30-second video about the 30-second video of racist rants was being discussed, they juxtaposed it with good white people saying, oh yeah, I think Black Lives Matter, blah, blah, blah. The typical thing they always do, which personalizes racism rather than understanding it or showing it as a system, not about good people, bad people, but a system where white people benefit, and the emphasis on forgiveness. And the Uyghur incident, I found it very insightful when the one white person said, you know, I think this is a problem with Uyghur, that it's insulting black people. He was pretty clear, so it shows that white people are not ignorant. And another thing that I noticed, the black woman who was speaking in one of the clips saying, regardless of my education, I'm still the black, you know, hole who worked in the corner. I think it completely destroys, because I keep hearing on Facebook a lot lately, this class struggle argument. And I think that such stances such as that show that class is largely irrelevant, in the sense that race is the overarching problem. Racism, white supremacy is the overarching problem, not class. I'm a strong advocate of that. And I think that's about it. I hope I covered it in enough time. Try to be success.
That was fantastic, sir. There was, I think, one other person who had not commented yet. If you want to take 60 seconds to get your thoughts in, 60 seconds, feel free.
Really quick.
Oh, it was... I don't know. I'm going to decide. We got 60 seconds before workplace racism, so.
All right. I just wanted to say really quick, anyone that was looking for a black doctor, I actually called my insurance company. There should be a number on the back of your card. Once you call that number, you have to ask for someone that speaks a specific language. I found out because I asked for a black doctor within my area. I was put on hold by the receptionist. She then came back and asked me, well, is there a specific language that you need your doctor to speak? So I'm assuming, like, you have to follow up with something like Patois, Swahili, or, like, one of the common languages that you can probably figure out that a black doctor will probably speak. Because if you just say English or something like that, then they're going to tell you, well, we can't find anyone by race, but we go by language. So that's all I wanted to share.
Interesting. We are going to transition to workplace racism. The Saturday program is going to be restructured because there are more people sharing for workplace racism, which is great. And that was pitched originally that should be a program to itself anyway. So once that happens, I guess there'll be more time for people to share about the news events or to ask questions or what have you. But the restructure is coming at some point. I just need to figure out what that will look like. I did have other comments that I wanted to get in, but the only thing I'll say with that video that they call the rant video, where you got this racist urchin in Maryland who was talking about Black Lives Don't Matter, which I said all along that's what it should be because that's true. But in that video, one of the folks who posted it on Facebook noted that when he was talking and he said black people are an inferior race, he had might even be a Welsing moment. He said an inferior rape, and he had to go back and catch himself and say race. I thought that was highly significant as well, if you watch that video again. With that, there were a lot of fairs, too, if you noted. I thought really poignant moments of fair, particularly when Dr. Cobb was speaking. This is the Arizona incident with the nigger T-shirts. She was talking Mac and Gatos, these two suspected racist radio hosts, when she said that these white children, that they nigger is one of the first 20 words that they get comfortable with. They have been brought up in this environment and boom, 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 just laying it down. And they say, oh, hey, wait a minute now, street hooker. You can't say that. You don't know that. That's not fair to make that sound. I thought that was classic and hugely important segment from that clip as well. Workplace racism, if folks have comments they would like to share, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We had a listener, they wrote in this week that their white boss said, sit down. And this person responded by saying, I don't feel like sitting down. I would rather stand. The white boss tells me, sit down before I terminate you, in quotes. The person said that they were upset and wanted to know if it would be worth their time to file a report. I don't know the context, in terms of tone and what the situation was. Was this a meeting? Were you all sitting, like, you know, in the break room, in an office, that sort of thing? That would be important just to get additional information about where the details about how this situation happened. My view, I mean, just not having that, it's kind of difficult. I would probably say that I doubt it would get very far in terms of, you know, saying that this white person demanding that you sit down or that you would lose your job. The immediate thought that popped in my mind would be to ask a question in terms of, you know, am I required, because I don't know the context of this, am I required to sit down, like, immediately? If I'm, you know, standing up to do this or standing up to do that or what have you, is everyone required to sit down immediately in the exact same situation and to get that clarified? That was the first thing that popped in my mind. It's just I had questions, and those are questions that I would probably want to ask depending on what the situation was. But just my immediate thought was that I doubt it would get very far in terms of making a report and trying to challenge that, and that's just not knowing the additional information around where this was, how this happened, what was the setting, which, you know, all of that, in my opinion, is very pertinent to this type of situation and being ordered to sit immediately. But if other folks have commentary workplace racism, feel free to chime in.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm going to be somewhat vague because I don't want to, you know, say too many details, but I spoke with a white female, you know, racist suspect on one day at work. She asked me a question about something that was just, you know, that was going to be done the following day, the very, very early in the morning. You know, one, the person that was supposed to carry out this, this job was sick. So she was like, so what are we going to do? I said, hey, don't worry about it. You know, don't worry about it. It'll get taken care of. And she was like, oh, okay. I had a very bad feeling about that. I was like, you know, she asked me that something racist is going to happen. Something's going to happen where it's going to come back to me. So the very next morning, I'm on my way to work and I get a text. And she was like, oh, they're going crazy because this this job isn't getting done in the morning, you know, first thing in the morning. I'm like, well, why don't you do it since you're there, you know? And I didn't hear anything back. So when I first come into work, then I get bombarded by several, you know, racist suspects like, oh, they're, you know, what's going on? This is not getting done. And then one particular racist suspect, female, another female was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you canceled this job that was supposed to be done. And I'm like, excuse me, what are you talking about? Like, cancel what? And then she started going on kind of like a tirade, raising her voice, not yelling, but loud enough to where, of course, other races could hear. And so I'm like, hey, look, I was like, don't, you know, don't talk to me like that. You don't know what you're talking about. If you got some issue with me, you need to come talk to me in private or whatever. And of course, prior to her talking to me, you know, she went to, like, I guess the the main supervisor that first thing in the morning before I came in was like, why, what's going on with this job? Why is it getting done? And of course, he didn't know because he's so far removed from that type of work. And then she went directly to my supervisor, you know, and was like, what's going on? I heard he canceled this. So my supervisor texts me like, hey, why did you do this? Why did you cancel that? You know, why did you do that? And I'm, you know, so I'm, my blood is, I was getting very angry and upset before I even got to work. So, and by the time, you know, we had that little discussion with the, a racist female, you know, I was very, very, very upset or whatever. So, you know, I explained to my supervisor what happened, that the person that was supposed to replace the person that was sick didn't do exactly what they were supposed to do. So that's the reason why the job didn't get done. So when I talked to the, you know, the white female the day before, I believe when she asked me the question, what's going to happen with this job, I pretty much believe she was not setting me up, but just kind of setting the mold. Yeah, maybe she was setting me up, just like, okay, let me see. And I think she went and just talked to this other lady, this other white lady, and knew that she was going to cause a big, you know, fuss and start ranting and raving about this job, which is no type of life or death situation, nothing very serious, man. And my thing is, these racists, they're really good at causing commotion, causing, particularly I have three white, their so-called supervisors that, and I believe it's a form of welfare. They don't do anything the majority of the day, but sit in their office and chill, relax or whatever. But they cause commotions, you know, like something minor will happen and they'll, oh my God, what's going on around here? You guys are doing this. They have no type of intention of correcting anything, or it's just all a political move so they can feel like they're, you know, I guess identifying problems or whatever, but they have no, you know, they have no intention on solving it. They just want to blow it up to make it look like something. But yeah, I was very, very upset this week at work. And then later, this racist suspect female came in and, hey, I need to talk to you. You got time? And, you know, I really wasn't feeling that at the time. But, you know, it's like, oh, I apologize. I hate working here. And, you know, I just, you know, got out of control. I didn't mean everything. And, you know, and I was like, okay, you know, but, you know, you shouldn't talk. You shouldn't raise your voice and blah, blah, blah. I really should have taken some more action against that. But I didn't. But. Yeah, that's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
Just about you being upset, I think you said that you were very upset at work this week. That right there, the stress of racism, white supremacy, we talked about that with Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, and just victims in general. That's why she said all the time, we do not qualify for mental health. White people do that deliberately to us, whether it's putting you in an area where you don't have clean drinking water, are having all sorts of noise contamination in your environment so that you can't have quiet to think clearly, just come in to cause these nonsense commotions on the job where you didn't even do anything. In fact, he reminded me of the book study session from yesterday, Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, where he was saying it was an enslaved black person and his white enslaver terrorist came in and just said, well, you're a slave, nigger, and it's time for me to beat you. And no, you didn't do anything wrong, but I realize that you haven't been beaten before, so we got to beat you. And, you know, I'm having fun. I don't get to have fun unless I do this. Whites do that sort of thing all the time. This comes up regularly, almost weekly, on the program where a non-white person has not committed any sort of violation, no infraction. They've done nothing incorrect. And white people come and say, you have done this wrong, and fuss and fuss. And to particularly to have some sort of public humiliation, which is exact thing that they would do on the plantation, to totally humiliate you on the job and have you upset and angry and ruin your whole week and just being stressed out. They do this sort of thing deliberately, particularly when you said that it looked like there was some setup involved where they were saying this before, like a day before everything kind of broke and the white woman saying, oh my gosh, you canceled this ticket and going to tell this person and that person and getting all these other people involved. Whites, they network. They talk to one another. I'm pretty sure that there was some dialogue about, yeah, let's do it and let's blame it on this person. That's another thing that seems to be standard racist procedure, to just blame black people for incorrect things, for problems that happen on the job when they know that this black person had nothing to do with it. This is just the fun that we get to have of terrorizing black people. When she comes in, eventually when they, I'm not going to say discovered, because I'm sure that they already knew that you hadn't done anything incorrect, that they just wanted to, this is their terroristic fun, coming in to give some sort of, oh, I'm greatly pained about what happened. I'm so sorry. Probably the only thing that I would say, question, well, what can we do to make sure that this never happens again? And let's get that in writing so that we never have this situation again. We're all here to do our job and to solve problems, but let's make sure that we never have an incident like this ever while working together again, and see if she has any suggestions. And if not, you can have some. I would also suggest for anyone, I'm not sure if I heard it clearly, but if this person was not your direct supervisor, because I've had this happen on the job as well, where it was a white person who was not my direct supervisor. I didn't have to answer to this person, and they, you know, were coming like they wanted to yell and fuss and have a big kerfuffle. I would disengage immediately. As soon as it gets to the point where they're yelling, cursing, raising their voice, making some sort of unfounded accusation, and just say, you know, sir, ma'am, the way that you're speaking right now, it is not, in my opinion, most conducive to us being able to solve this problem. I'm going to disengage. We can reconnect and try to solve this problem in the most constructive manner later on. If you want to give me an email and just state what the problem is, I'd be more than happy to try to work and solve this. But just the communication, that the way that you're speaking right now is not conducive to me being able to help solve this problem, so I'm going to disengage. And I would just walk away at that point. If they were in my office or what have you, I would just leave. I would go to the restroom or whatever the case may be. If it was someplace else, we were out in the hall or another place, I would just exit. But I would immediately stop the communication if it was not my immediate supervisor or the owner of the company or something of that nature. If you want to respond to that, I'm talking crazy, you can feel free. If other people had, you know, suggestions they wanted to ask or questions, they can feel free as well.
Guess not. I agree wholeheartedly. I also want to just say, Dr. Marimba Ani, she made something that really resonated with me with the rhetorical ethic, man. It's really like these people pretend like they're trying to do something for the good of people, and it's all political. Like, it's a reason behind it. So this lady was trying to act like she was trying to be this. You know, I'm so concerned about people, and I can't believe that you did this because you guys don't care. You don't care about your people, and I care. But she's kind of just sitting on her butt, just talking. But pretty much, I take everything that they do is all political. So if, you know, these white folks, even anything down to them bringing muffins into work, it's something that they're trying to gain somebody's favor, or they're trying to poison you with sugar, or, you know, or any type of thing that they're doing that's supposed to be for the good. It's political. It's for some other type of racist intent behind it. That's all I see. But I agree with everything you said.
Other folks, I think all the folks that dialed in with the hand up, if you all have commentary on workplace racism, feel free to chime in.
Have you heard?
Yeah. Did I hear a female caller?
You go ahead. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I was just making sure. I thought I did hear a female caller. If not, then, you know, that's fine. But did I hear a female caller speak up as well?
No.
All right. I think Firefighter relented, so feel free if you want to share, sir.
Okay. This is the caller that wrote in. And so the situation was we had a group meeting, and in this meeting, the boss was he stated more than several times something about this cheer that we have to do, like before a meeting. And the cheer consists of everybody standing up, everybody clapping, and repeating the words of the company, and saying that our store is number one, and the customer is number one always. So in my observation, none of the employees like doing the cheer. Okay. So that day when I came into work, I led the cheer that night. Okay. So before the shift ends, it's an emergency meeting call. Now, the real meaning of the meeting is this, how would I describe that? A anti-sexual relationship between two females that's going on in the workplace. And one of the females is abusing the other female. And so this is really what the meeting is about. But in the meeting, you know, he's talking about the cheer, and somebody walked out on the cheer. And, you know, we don't want to do that, and whatever, whatever, whatever. So the meeting's about to end. We're about to do the cheer. So I say, can I ask a question before we do the cheer? So he says, yes. And I asked the question. I said, what is the purpose of the employees doing the chair? And he went into a long, long song and dance about Sam Walton getting women's clothes and taking them from one location to another location. And at the end of the story, he said the word respect. So I asked him, I said, so respect is the reason why the employees do it here? That's the answer. And that pissed him off. So after the cheer was over, he called me in the office. So when we get in the office, he like shaking, red, you know what I'm saying? Like really hyped up and say, sit down. I said, I don't feel like sitting down right now. I'd rather stand. Sit down right now before I terminate you. And man, I sat down. And so I sat down. And we was, you know, having a conversation. I told him, I said, I feel a lot of adrenaline coming off your body. Your body language is very angry and aggressive. And I said, I feel like you want to put your hands on me, you know. And then once he kind of seen that I wasn't reacting, like, you know, aggressive, angry, you know, he kind of calmed down, you know, whatever, whatever. And then... he's, you know, basically backpedaling at this point and, you know, saying, well, you know, do you think that we should, you know, not do the cheer? Think we should just ask the cheer? I said, no, I didn't say that. I said, I asked the question seeking understanding and I didn't receive a clear answer. So I re-asked the question. And he said, well, you know, we do the cheer to motivate the employees before the shift. I said, that's an acceptable answer. I accept the answer. And so he's saying, well, you know, give me a minute. You know, I said, you know what? I felt like I've been mistreated in this room and disrespected, and I don't want to be around you another minute. Am I free to go or will I be terminated? And he said I could go, and I left.
Wow.
And that was it.
Fascinating. I'm reminded again of Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, the segment that we read yesterday, where it's, we have got to crush. I think Ross, he said it was black self-respect, but I think the way it's written in the book is self-assertion on the part of black people. It can't have them being confident and thinking for themselves, and particularly asking questions of me, like, nigga, are you crazy? It's time for the beatings to commence, which sounds like that's exactly what it was. Like, how dare you, you know, nigga, ask me a question in front of the group? Like, who do you think you are? And it sounds like, you know, it sounds like you, that's the way you interpreted to bring you in his office and demand that you sit down. In my view, that's a total power move. This whole books and people have broken down the whole psychology and the power dynamics of, you know, having people sitting and standing and the level when you're looking at someone and all that. But that sounds like exactly what it was. The only thing that I would say, I think just always great to stay in the question lane. And I think you just pointing out that it seemed like he was upset. Even that, you could pitch that in a question, you know, just looking at you, it seems like, you know, you might be a little upset with me right now. Are you angry with me? And if so, why? That might be a good question, because you said it seemed like he tried to refine and get himself composed when you made that comment about him seeming like he was upset right now. And then he answered your question. Just going back, now that I have more details about what you asked, should you file a report about being mistreated since he demanded that you sit down? I would say in that context, in the office, and you're having a meeting with him, I think it would be very difficult for white people. I just wouldn't expect other whites to say, yes, you were mistreated, and him demanding that you sit, or you're going to be terminated in that setting if you're in his...
part that I left out is that there was a witness in the office.
Okay. Another white person, or... a non-white
person? Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay. Was this like, what is their position? Are they like a secretary or another manager?
This is another manager.
Okay. I was, you know, I would still say if it's another white person, I just don't see them. We say all the time, whites form like Voltron. They are going to network and work together. I think it would be very difficult for whites to say, yes, this Negro was mistreated, and you can't be demanding that they take a seat, particularly in an office setting. I think most of the time they're probably going to say that that's acceptable, that particularly if this is a boss or supervisor, what have you, that they can demand, because, I mean, this was not a request. They can't order you to have a seat in this sort of setting if you're going to meet in his office or an office setting where we're going to have a meeting about something that took place. It seems very unlikely that they would support that you were mistreated in that context. But I could be wrong if you want to pursue that. Again, I would just go the question route in the if you do choose to pursue it, to file a report that you were mistreated and saying, you know, is this common procedure? If, you know, you're going to talk with someone and for whatever reason the person asks if they can, you know, remain standing, particularly since you're saying that you, from your observation, he seemed angry or upset at that time. You could tell from his body language and what have you. Is this typical procedure? Everyone is treated this way. Everyone is, you are ordered. Right now, you got to sit down or you're going to lose your employment with this company if you choose not to sit. Is that how everyone's treated? And just get that clarified. But my suspicion is that might be one that I would see from the very beginning that would not be likely to work out in my favor, but I could be in error.
And so following the incident, I went to work the next day, and I went and talked to another manager, and he said, you know, it was, and this was a non-white black person. So the first thing he asked me, well, did you get angry? Were you aggressive? You know, and I'm like, look, I don't want to file. I don't want to go to HR. You know, that's not what I want to do. Like on the job, they got these things where if you do something wrong, you can be coached, like, you know, a written disciplinary action that you sign and that goes in your file. OK, so what I told him, I said, well, what I would like, I said, I think that was an incident. I said that I feel that was a horrible abuse of power to hold my job over my head, not related to something that's going to make the company money, but, you know, something him controlling my body in that moment. You know, I said, I don't feel that was right. And I said, I think that was an incident. And what I would like to do is get the parties that were involved. And let's restate and recite the incident, what happened, what was said. And I would like the parties to sign it. If not, that's fine. But I would like that incident to go in my file as a disciplinary action would. And that's all I wanted to happen.
And his response?
He said that, you know, he said that was possible, but, you know, he was in defense with the company. I mean, he told me himself he's a company man. So, you know, I kind of already know where he's coming from.
He's not white. He's probably in the same position as you are. They might have done the same thing to him at some point, but that's about what I would expect if you know, any of the folks that are listening in, if they have, you know, observations or strategies in terms of how you would deal with this moving forward, if you think you would file a report, or, you know, just this is the system of white supremacy, these are some of the things you have to endure as you are trying to navigate this system and trying to maintain employment. If there are other folks who have suggestions or thoughts on how they would deal with this, if you'd like to share, feel free.
Let me add one more thing. I'm sorry.
Do you want to get the additional details, and then the folks that want to comment can do so?
Okay. Just the additional details. I recently started college classes at night. Mm-hmm. That's public knowledge around the workplace. I have my books and my book bag, and that was the last thing.
Oh, okay. I would say that's probably something else. We definitely are not in support of uppity niggers looking like they're trying to improve their life and get additional information. I'm assuming people, if they had strategies or comments on this, feedback in terms of how they might deal with it, if y'all had suggestions, feel free. Did the female caller, did you have a suggestion for this victim, or did you have something that's not related?
No, it's a suggestion, but I wanted to ask if the gentleman has a union where he works. Hello?
I can hear you. The victim that was just... Oh, yes, sir, we can hear you.
No, there's no union.
Okay, because from what I understand, and I'm not an HR professional, but I think it might be wrong in some instances to have two managers in a room, either counseling or reprimanding an employee. So, like in that case, you can ask that, you know, before you meet, if they're going to be two managers or supervisors meeting with you, that you have a union representative present or some kind of mediator so that you'll have a defense. So I think what they did was wrong initially in meeting both of them meeting with you at the same time, because then it would definitely be their word against yours. So that's just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was going to say, since the other manager that you spoke to was a company person, what I would do is take my own personal notes as to everything that happened, especially since it's so soon after the incident, your memory should be really fresh. Write down as much detail as possible, who was in the room, what was said, and just notate that for your own records. Don't depend on the company people to get it done for you. And that way, at least you have your own private record that you can hold on to in case if there's any other incidents with this person down the road, you can always go back to that and refer to that. Also, I was going to say, I think it was a great form of codification for you to maintain your composure and not to show any emotion. The reason why is because from the way you were explaining the story, it sounds like he wanted to fire you. His intention was to fire you. And when he did, like you said, take control of your body in that way, he was hoping he could agitate you into giving him more of a reason, simply because I don't think it would have made sense for him to say, well, he questioned me about the chant, and that's why I fired him. So if he could have combined that with, let's say, you reacting in a way that he could use against you, that would have made it all the more possible for him to get rid of you. So I think that was really a good thing that you did. And I would just suggest writing it down. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Other folks have suggestions, or if not, if you had something else you wanted to make sure you bring up for workplace racism?
Hello, may I be heard?
I heard two people. The first caller, your volume is very, very low. Need to speak up.
Me?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Not the second. The person who said me, no. Your volume is fine. It's the other caller.
Okay. Yeah. Well, can I go? My turn?
Yes, sir. You can go.
Yeah. I had workplace racism. Really is pertaining to be a good when you say do not attend work parties. I try to stay codified on that as best I can, but I guess I'm in this past week I've been hit with a little peer pressure. Well, not peer pressure, but just pressure from my boss. They've been telling us for the past couple weeks we had the big manager over our district coming down from Montgomery, coming down and bringing a grill. They're gonna cook and stuff, have fun outside. I never really been a big fan, you know, of the company get-togethers or whatever. But you know, since I started listening to the show, I put emphasis on it to stay away. So you know, I really wasn't planning on going at all. You know, they'll bring it up and I'll be like, okay. And I was just planning on making up some bogus lie, something to skip over. But one day, I walk into the office and I see my boss. He's kind of
he's rearranging my workload for that day. You know, making it smaller, and you know, I already owe my workload, so I decided to step in then and say, hey, you know, was it mandatory? Do I have to be there? And he kind of looked at me crazy, and he's like, yeah, you know, coming all the way down from Montgomery and bringing the grill, and you know, just gonna have ribs. You ought to be there. And you know, I try to talk myself out of it a little bit. Say, oh, you know, ribs. You know, I don't eat ribs. You know, I just made that up. I really just ain't want to go. You know, because I ain't want to be around white people at work and party and stuff. And also, I just, you know, I can find way better things to do with my time. I really don't like being at work like that. But yeah, it was like a little peer pressure or whatever. And he got on the phone and he was like, oh, hey, well, we have a chicken. And, you know, I guess he expected me to, oh, okay, yeah, I'll be there. Like, you know, be happy to be there, you know, have real. Kids and chicken. But anyway, I ended up going anyway, you know, because I ran out of excuses. After that point, and I get there, you know, everybody's there and stuff, and the big boss man, he pulls out a bottle of Hennessy, just throws it on the table, and you know, I didn't have any with him, all that type of stuff, because you know we was gonna get in our company cars and leave, you know, they want me to drink with him, then get in my car and drive off right in front of him. I don't think that'll be, you know, codified at all. But you know, but I was totally pressured into going anywhere, and I was wondering if you probably had some thoughts on like being almost made to go to these little company functions or whatever and sit out there and talk and eat ribs, chicken or whatever. You know, and of course, I wasn't finna just drink in front of my boss and drop out. I'm sorry, you gonna say something?
Number one, I'm surprised that watermelon didn't come up since they threw all the other things in to try to entice you to attend. I have tried to refine over the years. You can be required, because that has come up before where people have said, you know, that they have been required to attend these type of functions if it's a workplace type situation. So sometimes you don't have the option of declining, just saying, you know, I'm not going to go. Sometimes they make it mandatory. Where I've said for those is to just codify your behavior. Excellent in declining the alcohol. That is outstanding. You want to do that every time if you are required to attend. And I think we've even had some of our listeners, I call in Michigan, who thought that her declining to go, I think it was out to lunch with some of her previous employees, that might have led these suspected racists that she works with to terminate her. So sometimes you just have to make a decision about, is it in your best interest to attend? Is it voluntary? I would always ask that. Is it voluntary? And then maybe even to codify if they have something like this on a regular basis that maybe you do once every month, or once every other month or something like that, so they can't say that you never attend, but you just don't make a habit of attending if it's something that's about, like, they go out to lunch, something like that. I would not participate at all. But it sounds like the alcohol, outstanding to not participate. It just sounds very tacky the way the whole thing was structured in terms of the way that they were trying to entice you to participate, and I've seen that consistently as well, where it can be very just very crude in terms of the way that they're talking and want to get you to come and dance and be the entertainment and that sort of thing, or just be the source of a lot of jokes at these sort of functions. So it sounds like you did a great job of codifying your behavior, even though they made you go, which happens sometimes. You just have to do the best you can in remaining codified if you are required to attend.
Yeah, I had asked him, was it mandatory? And he looked at me and was like, oh, like with disgust, like, man, you know, our big boss, our boss is coming down from Montgomery, he's going to have ribs, you know, like that's supposed to be a big factor for me. Like, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to be there for ribs. But, yeah, they kind of cornered me a little bit, so I ended up going. And, you know, I really didn't want to be there. It was starting to be obvious that I didn't want to create that type of environment, like I'm the runaway, you know, Negro or whatever. And yeah, so I just tagged along. But yeah, I totally understand. That's all I had. You know.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I just wanted to know how many of the employees at your job are black?
I would say it's probably 30% black. Everybody's like more older type. I believe I'm actually might be the youngest guy at my company. Period.
Because they came with, you know, they came with ribs, chicken, and Hennessy. You know what I'm saying? Like. So you know that was irresistible. I figured it was more black at your job than that. And I had a comment to make about the poll before. I just wanted to say quickly, if he was able to, and you know, I'm no expert, but if you're able to get it in an email, detail information about what happened, and maybe send that to that black manager, and maybe at the end say, I've decided, you know, I'm not going to go any further in pursuance with this, but just so that it's on record with the company email, so if they ever come back to you later, you know, because I have a feeling that, you know, there was two white people in the office, and one felt showed up by in front of the other, that there's going to be some retaliation. So you just have a record of that. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Great point.
That's gonna say a great point. That's why I wanted to make a record. But thanks for that.
Right on. Other folks who had a hand up that we have not heard from, if you had something you wanted to share related to workplace racism, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you. Y'all can decide who wants to go first.
Okay, you can go first.
Okay, good looking. Hey, how's it going, guys?
Right poorly. Good to hear from you, sir.
Great. I work at a panel shop, an electrical panel shop. All we do every day is we make electrical cables and we wire panels. That's it. So one day, the shop supervisor pulls me into his boss's office. And they tell me, they say, you're making cables too slow. I tell them, you got some new temps here. So I've been picking the harder cables and letting them, you know, do the faster cables so they can, you know, keep up and move, you know, things smoothly. My shop supervisor immediately says they don't take any longer. They all same amount of time to do one than the other. I just looked up and I just said, okay. Y'all been here longer than me. In my mind, I'm thinking, y'all been here longer than me. I'm not going to argue. Y'all playing games. So we ended the meeting. I go back out there, and I just start picking the quicker cables to make up. Since you get no, you know, pat on the back for taking the longer ones, so I just do all the shorter ones. But anyways, the next week, I come into work. The shop supervisor pulls me in the conference room and he says, every day I've been here for a year and I always get two panels done a day. So, well, this morning he pulls me in the office and he says, I want your two panels done by noon. And immediately I thought of the book, The Half Was Never Told, and, you know, my cotton sack must be a little light. You know what I mean? Like, how you going to ask me to do more than what I do in a full day and half a day? So I just go out to my bench, pack up my tools, and I work on my panel. So he, you know, seeing me do this, he goes grab his boss. Well, when his boss comes in, they call me back to the office again. But I already know they hand. Y'all just playing some games, you know what I mean? Y'all trying to get twice the work out of me. And like Neely Fuller says, y'all just do this for fun. So in my head, I think I know what y'all game, you know what I mean? So I go to the office, and his boss tells me, no. We had a meeting before this. Here we go. Sorry about that. We had a meeting that day with his boss. There's everyone in the conference room, same conference room that he and I were just in. And then his boss comes in. They want everybody, the whole shop in there. So we get in the shop, and his boss comes in, and he's like, oh, I'm pissed with some attitude. And he gives his heads are going to roll speech, and everybody's kind of nervous. And then he goes, I'll just say John for now. I want those two panels done by noon because my shop supervisor told me he wanted them done by noon. I told him right there in the conference room, they won't be done by noon. I told my shop supervisor I wasn't going to have them done by noon. And I already got my tools packed up and I'm ready to go. So they both had this little shocked look in their face, like how he know our hand, you know what I mean? So we all go back. They, say, well, let's get it going. We all go back out to the benches. So I'm like, everybody in the shop looking at me like, whoa, what's going on? I'm saying, hey, I don't like to be mistreated. Give me my tools. Anybody got any of my tools, give them to me. They fire me, whatever. I won't allow that. But, my self-respect is way too high. Like, I just won't allow that. So anyways, the day ended. The next morning, I wake up. My son's a senior in high school. He and I live together. I just figure I'm going to take him out to breakfast before school. So I go into work 2 hours late, because I really don't want to be around these people anyways. Now that I know, y'all playing little sick games for whatever reason, I really don't want to participate anyway. I can do something else, But I go into work 2 hours late. My shop supervisor, his boss calls me, answer my phone. He says, where you at? I'm at my bench. So they call me back into his office. Now, both of them in there complaining about, what's going on and blah, blah, blah. I told y'all, I can't get any more than two panels done a day. That's all I'm going to do. Y'all want more, Y'all, I told them, y'all don't have to treat me how y'all treat everybody else. I said, watch y'all drag people out of this shop. I said, you don't have to drag me out. Open the door. I'll walk out of here. So they looked at me. But before that, they were talking about how they were going to write me up for being 2 hours late. And I looked at them like, go ahead, I don't want to be here anyway. So he says, well, we're going to start you out with a clean slate. I'm thinking to myself, y'all just told me y'all was going to write me up, three write-ups, I'm out of here. Now I'm stuck leaving here with a clean slate. Like, y'all play so many games. And my mom just saying, y'all play so many games. Like, it's a shame. So I'm like, whatever, clean slate. Go out here, and I'm working in the shop for another week. And today, shop supervisor, he says, hey, you all talking too much over there, so. We go back, so I'm at my bench, just working, and the white boy in front of me turns around and he starts talking to me. Now, this boy that got out of his seat, turned, stood up, and started talking to me. Now, shop supervisor see that. He don't say nothing, and then it gets, we just sitting there talking, and now the boy stands up again, does the exact same thing, sits back down, and we keep talking. He comes in and he says, Terry, I want, clock out. I want you to go right now. Like, we done, it's been, you're just talking too much. And I'm just like Neely Fuller now. Like, I don't play no games. Let's get straight to the point. I say, am I working here or not? Like, are you going to fire me? You ain't going to fire me. He said, well, blah, blah, blah. Grab all my tools again. And I walk out and I said, well, I'll be here Monday for a little bit more mistreatment because I just won't quit on them out of my respect. Like, y'all just, just play so many games, and I'm going to expose y'all in front of the rest of this shop. Because it don't matter to me. I see y'all for the little cowards, and I think it's perverted. Because if I didn't know any better, y'all be sitting around having me doing twice the amount of work. My hands will look like claws by the time I'm done. And all for fun and just to double profits. But yeah, that's my little workplace racism for the last past couple weeks.
Exactly. Third time. Half has never been told. Exactly. Your cotton sack is a little short pounds. Time for the beatings and just having fun. Terrorizing black people. It's standard operating procedure. They've been doing the exact same thing for centuries. Unless folks had a suggestion or comment, I believe that was our young caller in the Bay Area who had a hand up who also was going to comment.
Yes, may I be heard?
Loud and clear. Before you get your story, I just wanted to ask, did you see the incident in San Francisco where they had the, what do they call it, the Wigger Party, quote unquote? Did you see that?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't seen that.
That is right in your area. I will email it to your mother so that you can check it out. But that's right down the street from you. Proceed. What you wanted to share with us, sir?
All right. Well, in my English class, we just finished talking about Borderlands. And one of the texts that we read is called The Lesson, and it's by this black author named Tony K. Barbara. So in the lesson, there's this black tutor named Miss Moore. She has a college degree, according to the text. And she's taking these black children who are mostly poor to this toy store founded by this guy named Frederick August Otto Schorst. He is a toy retailer, and the store is actually named by him, after him. So they go to the store by a taxi cab, and when they go into the store, the children just roaming around and stuff. They notice all of these different things, like the microscope, and that cost $300. And they just noticed how highly overpriced that was. And Miss Moore asked one of the children, how long would it be to save up their allowance to buy that microscope? And the child said, too long. It would be too long. And that would have shown how poor they were. So they're just looking around all of these highly overpriced toys, and one of the characters noticed a clown that's $35, a toy clown. And she just starts naming the stuff that she could do, she and her family could do with all of that money. They could pay the rent, they could pay the piano bill, they can go see their grandfather across the country. They could do a lot of stuff with that type of money instead of buying that toy. And personally, I think Miss Moore took the children to FAO Schwartz because to show them the social structure and where they fit in according to that. For example, most of those children actually fit at the bottom where all the poor people are. But some other children, like this little girl named Mercedes, she has most of the stuff that she needs, so she's somewhere close to the middle of the social structure. And at the top, it's just all of the rich people that can afford almost anything. And that's all I wanted to share about that. Thank you.
I know typically they have some sort of discussion about this type of literature when you read. Did you share your observations about the text with your classmates or during the class where you all talked about this?
Oh, yes, I did. We had a discussion, like a Socratic seminar based on the text.
Mm.
So, yeah, I shared my observation through that.
Okay. Did the teacher or anybody else make any comments on what you shared?
Yeah, they did, but, yeah.
Okay. This is a black author, Tony Cade Bambara, I think pretty popular in many literature classes. White people, for whatever reason, they don't have a problem teaching or reading Bambara's material. I've seen quite a bit of it pop up during my experience, college classes, even some high school classes where it'll pop up. Fascinating. That'll be one definitely if you all are reading other black authors or texts where it looks like racism is kind of popping up in the text, or at least in your observation is popping up in the text. Definitely kind of let us know what you're reading and then how they respond if you present any views or if they have any interesting observations about the material that you all are covering. Right on. Good to hear from you, sir. Did anybody have anything else they want to share, workplace racism, before we wrap things up?
Yes, I did.
I had a conversation with a black female coworker this week, and she was telling me that, especially where I work is in the healthcare industry and the insurance company, and she actually was one of the sales reps, and she works now in a different location, but we used to work in the same location. She got married recently. She's very young, probably like in her mid-20s, and she got married recently a couple months back, and she's now pregnant. And with the salespeople, basically, they do hire some of them permanently, but the vast majority of them are only hired through the open enrollment period. And then after open enrollment, they basically let them all go. It's like a temporary type of situation. So with her just getting married and now being pregnant, she was trying to transition from the sales department either into a different department that would be permanent, or see if she can facilitate being made permanent as a sales rep. And but I think she really wanted to transition to a different department. So during her time as a sales rep, she helped to facilitate creating templates to make the process easier as far as enrolling people and making the process as smooth as possible. So she had a lot of handiwork in the development of the department. And she had told me that once she went to try and interview for another position, they basically didn't want to give her the position because she was pregnant, and they just didn't say it in so many words. And she had told me at one point when she went to submit her resume and try and facilitate an interview, they literally asked her, what did she do, as if she didn't do all the things that she had done before. And right now she's still trying to see what she can do, but she basically is under the understanding that they're not going to keep her. And essentially, they don't want to have to deal with her taking maternity leave shortly after getting the position, is essentially what it is. And that, since I've been there, I've now been there for about 6 months, I've seen quite a few black people walked out of the building for usually attendance or if there was a medical situation. And then there was another sister that I talked to a few months back, and she did not get adequately trained, and they were basically setting her up to let her go. But through her and I having ongoing discussion, she was offered a position through a family member of hers. And it was something that she was interested in. And I told her, well, take the position. It's better for you to transition than to let them fire you for any reason and let that be a blemish on your work history. So she actually took the other position, and I actually bumped into her a couple, like a month ago or something, and she's actually way better off than where she was. But I'm just watching how even for those people who do good work, it's not a guarantee. You know, just being black, for her being pregnant, and that pregnancy being a quote-unquote inconvenience for the company, is allowing them to basically nix all of the work that she's ever done, and she's done quite a bit to help facilitate the growth of that department, for them to basically let her go because, for them, it's an inconvenient pregnancy. And it's just something that I wanted to put out there so people can think about that, because I think we've talked about that before. There was another black female I remember on the program that called back, I guess a few months ago, and talked about them letting her go for doing too good a job. So I don't ever get comfortable, even though I do a good job where I am. I don't get too comfortable with that whole idea of job security based on you doing good work. It doesn't matter if you're black, they can walk you out of there for whatever reason they choose to make up. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Never think just doing great work or doing a good job or getting an exemplary rating is going to protect you from whites on the job. That is just, unfortunately, that is not the case. And I would even contrast that, because they've been having all this talk about extending maternity leave. And, you know, we want to look out for women's rights. And if you're pregnant in the workplace, I seriously doubt that that is going to extend to black females. And we've even had black people on the program before who have said when whites see, same thing kind of that I was saying the previous caller that talked about taking night courses, going to college. If you're, you know, looking like you're trying to improve your situation, improve your quality of life, get better education, whites are not interested in helping you do that. They want to sabotage that. Let's see if we can mess your schedule up or switch it so that you have to work later hours. So that'll disrupt your school schedule. Oh, you're getting married? Oh, let's see if we can mess up, you know, your work situation to stress out, you know, your newlywed life. That's just the type of folks that we are around. Tacky, trashy, terroristic, triple T, all day, every day. That is what it means to be white. But I will throw out suggestion, if folks have in mind a day that would be good for workplace racism, at least my initial thoughts, I have to think about a little bit more to restructure the compensatory call-in, even though I would prefer to keep workplace racism in, just if more people are going to participate so that folks can, you know, chat about the news incidents that have taken place, or if you have other observations, we have time for that, and then adequate time for workplace racism so that that's not getting cut short, so that people have suggestions, people can share. If there is a day that would be better for people's schedule, you can share, or if you have other ideas about how to restructure so that there will be adequate time for all components of what we're touching on, you can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, to kind of think about moving forward so that everybody is able to participate fully and get in whatever commentary they would like. But just drop me an email if you have a day that would be good to move and just have an exclusive program that is on workplace racism where folks can dial in and participate. I did not want to do that initially because it was very difficult to get people to participate and speak up for workplace racism, but hopefully that will change. If you can just let me know a day that would be good, I guess a day and a time that would be good where folks can participate, and we'll see about doing the restructure, or if you have other ideas about restructuring the compensatory call-in so that we can make sure that everybody is able to participate fully and we're not missing callers because we're running out of time. With that, we will be back later in the week. You just have to check Black Talk Radio and the Facebook page to get the update for the programs that are coming up at the beginning of February. If there are any folks, if we have readers out there, a book that I am enjoying that ties very closely to The Half Has Never Been Told, it's The American Slave Coast by Ned Sublett. He's one of the co-authors. He's a white person, unfortunately, but it does have a lot of constructive information. If you're enjoying The Half Has Never Been Told, you will enjoy The American Slave Coast. It is very, very good. Still a white author, you know, got to keep your alert, but it does have a lot of good information. He is coming on the program, and his white wife, who also co-authored the book, they will be on the program the Monday after next. Now, this is a very big book. We will never do this for the book club. It's like an 800-page book. If we have any readers and you want to read, check it out and prepare for his visit in like 10 days, feel free. Let me know if you have any observations. I started reading it earlier this week. It is fascinating. But with that, we will wrap things up. Thanks to all the folks who participated. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Again, we will be back soon for the beginning of the week. If you have gripes, complaints, suggestions, thoughts on restructuring the compensatory call-in, or a day that would be good for the workplace racism segment, just drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Fundraising for 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Thanks again to all the folks who have invested in us. Again, I hope the program continues to be worthy of your time and energy and is offering constructive information to help you get a better understanding of white supremacy and even some strategies for how to counter racist man, racist woman, racist child. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of war. You do not want to be behind the wheel, a passenger, even a pedestrian, with Daniel Holtzclaw's, Darren Wilson's, out and about and specifically looking for folks with melanin. You are putting yourself in a dangerous, potentially life-threatening situation. If you are not lucid and clear-thinking so that you can make great decisions, you certainly do not want to be around intoxicated whites. That is an environment that is astronomically dangerous. I don't even encourage being around intoxicated non-white people. We already have enough problems. We do not need to do anything that is going to add strife to our existence as victims of racism. That's it. Creator, help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. Help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate maximum black self-respect every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.